The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
You're very welcome along this Monday morning to OTB Sports Radio. It's OTB AM. It's Gerry Gilroy and Owen Sheehan with you until 9:30 this morning. We're here every morning of the week, Monday to Friday at 7:30, bringing you a rundown of all the big stories of the day and some of the biggest interviews in sport. Today, though, there's really only one place that we can start, and that's the news overnight. I suppose yesterday evening, it was 10 a.m. LA time, that Kobe Bryant's helicopter went down. It looks like there were 8 people on board, and details were very sketchy at the start. Some horrific levels of reporting, particularly from ABC, about who was actually on board the helicopter. And as the time has gone on, we've learned that Kobe Bryant and his daughter and a bunch of other parents were travelling to the Mamba Academy, where Kobe Bryant trained kids how to play basketball.
Yeah, exactly. That's the Mamba Sports Academy is something that Kobe's been involved in on the way there. That's where it went down. And as you said yesterday, kind of a lot of confusion as to what was actually happening here, who was on the helicopter, and whether or not some of the reports were false or not. And you had a sheriff from the police department over there yesterday kind of criticising TMZ for their reporting on it immediately, given that a lot of the families wouldn't have even known the news until the word had filtered through that Kobe Bryant was dead. But it's incredible, really. It's something that is just such a horrifying story for all those people involved, for all the families involved. And you're only starting to see now the kind of drip feed of the tributes towards Kobe in particular from former teammates, from NBA legends, from commentators around the world who've been reflecting on his sports career, from the stuff he's done on the court to the stuff he's done off the court, and the incredibly complex character that he was in good ways and in terrible ways as well. So it's interesting. We're going to be getting word from LA very shortly, hearing about the scenes at the Staples Center, for example, last night, where you've got a lot of adoring Kobe fans, I'd imagine, laying down wreaths and jerseys and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so the Grammys are on at the Staples Center as well. Nine passengers were on board the helicopter, including the pilot. The LA County Sheriff confirmed during the news conference that happened, and it looks like there was a couple of parents and kids on board that as well. So fairly horrific details from that. We'll get to that in just a couple of minutes. Let me tell you what else is coming up, because obviously it was a very busy weekend in sport. Anthony Moyle is going to join us to talk to us about the weekend, which was really David Clifford's weekend. Top five stories are probably going to involve David Clifford as well, bringing sports headlines. More reaction from Ryan Jones around about 10 to 9 this morning. And then Jason Sherlock's going to join us. He's obviously a huge basketball fan as well. And Kevin Caban, fresh from another week's survival on... I always get this wrong. Is it Dancing on Ice?
It's Dancing on Ice.
Yeah, I like Dancing with Ice, Dancing with Stars.
You've got Dancing with the Stars at the same time, Dancing on Ice. It's a confusing time to be a television watcher, Ger.
It definitely is. All right, if you want to get in touch this morning, you can drop us a comment in the live stream wherever you're watching it. We stream this across YouTube, Facebook, and of course on Periscope. The best place to get us is on offtheball.com. And obviously we're live all day, every day on OTB Sports Radio, which is our radio station. Best place to listen to that is on the Go Loud app, where you can get all your podcasts as well. So yeah, you never have to leave the environment. Right, let's head to LA and let's cover our top story today.
OTB AM.
Okay, let's go to LA and join Kavitha Davison, whose work you can read in The Athletic. She's the presenter of a podcast on the Wondery Network for The Athletic as well. Kavitha, good morning to you. Good evening to you. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm as well as one can be in these circumstances.
You've been to the Staples Center. I didn't actually know the Grammys were on tonight as well. I've just seen Alicia Keys was saying in the Grammys that we're here in the house that Kobe Bryant built. So this is kind of the locus, really, of people gathering around. We've just put an image up from your Twitter feed on screen there. The scene outside Staples is surreal. People in Kobe jersey mixed with people in sequined ball gowns for the Grammys. Amid the tears, the crowd breaks into somber applause when this comes on screen. And it's a picture of Kobe Bryant with the years he was alive. What was that scene like?
It was, I mean, it was exactly what I said. It was surreal. It was hard to believe. It was really, really silent is something that really strikes me. This is a part for people who've never been to this part of LA or Staples Center. It was actually outside of Staples Center because the perimeter of Staples Center was blocked off for the Grammys that were later tonight. But you know, it's this area called LA Live. It's a huge outdoor plaza. There's usually music and street performers and people celebrating and just having a good time. And you know, while it was still crowded, there were still a lot of people there. It was just silent. And when they put that tribute, that in memoriam photo on the screen, you know, the crowd broke out into applause. People started an MVP chant. They started a Kobe chant, and there was just sobbing everywhere. And it was really hard to witness and be a part of.
The city of LA is obviously where Kobe Bryant has spent his entire career as a Laker, and I think for you know a lot of people here probably won't understand exactly just how totemic a figure he was in the reemergence of the Lakers as a force. He ends up winning five championships with them, and is a figure in their history as big as any of the other great figures in their history, like Magic Johnson or anybody else. What was it that allowed him to succeed in LA?
I think if you ask different Lakers fans, they'll give you different answers. A lot of them will say Shaq is absolutely one of those things. And you know, Lakers ownership, the Buss family, led by Jerry Buss, who has now passed as well, really made Kobe their franchise player. And you know, if you're talking about on the court, though, Kobe had a tenacity. He had a drive. He had the best work ethic of anyone you'll ever meet. And he could just do things with the ball that you didn't think anybody who wasn't named Michael could do. And it was really this era of the NBA that, you know, you didn't know what was going to happen post-Michael. Kobe Bryant was drafted in 1996. The Lakers, with Kobe and Shaq, really start to make a name for themselves in 1999. And then they win three straight championships from 2000 to 2002. And I think Kobe, he didn't do it alone. But for a lot of those years after Shaq left, he kind of had to. And what I think people will always remember about him is he was the face of this franchise. He was the hardest working person on the court. Magic Johnson himself said, in paying tribute to Kobe Bryant today, said, "We lost the greatest Laker of all time." And that's quite a statement from someone like Magic.
It's not an uncomplicated legacy that Kobe Bryant leaves behind, though, because obviously there's a very serious rape allegation made at the absolute peak of his celebrity. In the initial rush of what happened in the aftermath of the helicopter crash, that wasn't being spoken about very much, but that part of the story seems to be being spoken about a bit more in US media circles over the last few hours. Is that correct?
I'd say so. And I think, you know, this is something that I struggle with a lot. I've been very public about being a sexual assault survivor myself. And as a sports writer, this is a dilemma and a conflict that I confront and that many people confront a lot. I think in the immediate aftermath of just trying to figure out what was true and what wasn't, separate the facts from the rumor, it felt like not the right time to bring something up like that. And in our episode tomorrow, we don't really touch on it. We just deal with the immediate reaction. But I think when you're talking about Kobe Bryant's legacy, it's impossible to ignore. It's impossible to ignore what he was accused of, what there is tangible evidence of, and how for a lot of fans, myself included, who loved Kobe Bryant on the court and can appreciate how much he brought to this game, to the city of LA, to Lakers fans, it's a very difficult and complicated legacy to contend with.
It feels a little bit like the city of LA decided that he was their guy and that whatever had happened in Colorado almost wasn't their business, and they got behind him, while the rest of the country definitely didn't seem to have exactly the same sense of Kobe Bryant, the man that LA did.
I mean, I think that happens whenever an athlete or musician or someone is accused of something like this. You know, if you've already developed a fandom, you have these preconceived notions of who this person and this player is as a human being. And the fact that those two things are not always reconciled is really difficult to deal with. When I first heard of Kobe Bryant's death today, and I don't say this lightly, it reminded me a lot of the day that Michael Jackson died. I remember exactly where I was, and I remember the minute by minute minute breakdown of how I found out, initially not believing it, and then going throughout the course of the day and watching the domino effect. You know, I was on the streets of, I was in Columbus Circle in New York City, and on the streets of Manhattan, you see, you heard and you saw people get the phone call and get the text message, and the exact same thing happened in LA today. And I talked to more than one fan who unprompted brought up that comparison as well. And just as, you know, there are certain people who die and you remember where you were when you heard about them dying, Michael Jackson and Kobe Bryant were two of those people. I think similarly, we struggle with how much we love these two people and how big of fans we are of these two people's work with what we know of them as people and what they may have done off the court and outside of the recording studio.
I think, too, one last point for me, Owen, before I let you in. The complicating factor in all this, of course, is that his teenage daughter has died in the helicopter as well. And so I think anybody who's a parent or anybody who knows any teenagers or anybody who's actually been alive can't but feel like awful shock at the fact that this girl who we have footage of playing basketball and, you know, draining a jump shot and her father being so proud of her on Jimmy Kimmel, and also then her dad and her having the conversation, I don't know if it was the Staples Center, but it looked like it was, about, you know, what position on the court should be. You could just see that there was this very natural father-daughter relationship, and I think that's also adding on a layer of complexity to how people feel about what's going on today.
Absolutely. And, you know, I haven't allowed myself to fully process. I haven't allowed myself to cry. The closest I came was when I came across some photos of Gianna and her dad, of Gigi and Kobe. And, you know, Kobe Bryant had four daughters. Gigi was the second oldest. She was 13 years old. And people would ask him constantly, you know, when are you going to have a son? Who's going to carry on your legacy? And Gigi would just turn to them and say, "Oi, I got this. You know, I'm going to carry on your legacy." And she absolutely, she and her father shared a love for basketball. That's what they were doing today. They were in the helicopter going to a travel team tournament that he was coaching her in. And it's really, it's a huge loss. I can't even imagine what the family is going through, but it is something that a lot of the fans that I talked to down at Staples Center had their kids with them and brought their kids. And it, you know, when they heard the news, they just hugged them even tighter.
It's interesting, Kavitha, when we talk about the legacy, I guess, of Kobe Bryant, and when you speak about the allegation in 2003 and how he, I don't want to use the word recover from that, but how he saved his career post that, and like Kobe Bryant's Muse, the documentary that came out in 2015, he doesn't really go into it, he's never really gone into it at all, but he spoke about creating the Black Mamba mentality, which is on the pitch crushing his opponents and destroying anything that would tarnish his own reputation. And I think that sort of attitude is something that perhaps was evidenced off the court as well. This was something that was not going to derail his career. He was ruthless on the court. His career was also going to survive off it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's one of the things that makes this so difficult when you're considering Kobe's legacy, is that Black Mamba mentality that so many of us respect on the court, the idea that that's applied off the court, that something like a rape allegation is something not only that you have to recover from, but something that happened to you, that this is adversity for, you know, somebody who is accused of doing things like this, and that that Black Mamba mentality is what got him through that. I think that that's very difficult for people to reconcile with, you know, how other people go through things like that. And certainly without any consideration really for what the victim or the accuser goes through in situations like that. We saw this come up again a little bit in 2016 when he retired, but you know, to be honest, I think a lot of the people who wanted to talk about this part of his legacy were being shouted down by people who mostly said, listen, this is a time for celebration and a time for retrospective and a time to look back at one of the greatest careers we have ever been lucky enough to witness. And all of that is true, but you can't ignore the complicated parts of someone's legacy when considering the parts that are easy. You know, the five championships, the two NBA Finals MVPs, the 18 All-Star games, those are easy things to consider, and we are lucky to have seen them. But all of these other things also need to be part of this conversation.
Yeah, like both of these things can be true, and I think you make the very valid points that this is such a tragedy, especially when you consider all the people involved in this crash yesterday. And perhaps even as well, there's if you're a Lakers fan standing outside the Staples Center, the people that you were speaking to last night, perhaps there is no correct way to feel about all of this. There could be a lot of confusion in those emotions. That being said, I'm sure outside the Staples Center, it is mostly love for Kobe at this moment.
It is. It really is. And I think the most important thing is that it's not my job. It's nobody's job to police someone else's grief, to tell somebody that they're not allowed to mourn, because this is an ultimate tragedy. And, you know, there is so much love and so much of an outpouring outside of Staples Center right now, and really across the country, and you'll see it across the world as well. You know, basketball is one of those sports that has managed to transcend American boundaries. Kobe is beloved in China, for example, and, you know, he grew up partly in Europe when his dad was playing internationally. Kobe's fluent in Italian, spent a lot of time in Italy in his formative years. So I think that this is something, you know, that we will continue to see in the coming days, not just in LA. You know, the Knicks and the Nets played in New York and had some demonstrations. The Empire State Building was lit up in purple and gold. You know, Kobe is absolutely one of those figures who transcends sports.
Yeah, and the Clippers are due to play against the Lakers, so it's a Los Angeles derby on Wednesday? So
I think it's Tuesday.
Tuesday. So is that game going to go ahead?
As of now, yes. And frankly, I'm very surprised at that. I'm very surprised that the NBA didn't cancel games today. And I know that that's not easy to do. There's a lot of logistical considerations. There's a lot of financial considerations, you know, television contracts and makeup games and how to schedule those. But I really am kind of surprised that this game, as of now, between the Lakers and the Clippers at Staples Center is still scheduled to go forward.
All right. Kavitha, thanks very much for joining us late your night and early our morning. So thanks a million for taking our call.
Absolutely. Thank you.
OTB AM.
Let's bring you through the top five stories. One, obviously, the death of Kobe Bryant in a helicopter accident on Sunday morning, California time, Sunday evening, our time. We'll get further analysis and reaction to the legacy and the career that Kobe Bryant put together a little bit later on with Ryan Jones of Slam Magazine. David Clifford's, wow, what a performance from David Clifford at the weekend. Brian Kerr, maybe going back to the FAI, the new president, the president-elect as of Saturday, has said that he is friends with Kerr and wants to get Kerr back involved with the FAI. Jerry McEnany is his name. Tip Limerick, one of the games of the weekend in the hurling. Obviously a 10-point lead for Tipperary at one point. Limerick ended up winning the game. Tip hit the crossbar in the last minute with a free from distance to try and win it. And Jurgen Klopp, pissed off Jurgen Klopp. Just a little bit of a wrinkle. Is this? He's not going to respect the traditions of the FA Cup. He's going to put out his B team. Where do you want to start? We should start with, I mean, I wanted to do the power rankings as how they were going to finish at the end of the season. And I was going to put Kerry first. And you were like, oh, you're just pulling the chain. You're just winding me up. You're trying to trigger me. I'm not. I legitimately think that Kerry are going to win the All-Ireland this year. And now everybody's going to start thinking it because Clifford just done what he did.
I'm not sure how that changes, how Saturday night changes that.
Because everybody's going to believe it now. It's completely believable.
Well, a Dublin supporter would tell you that they've got two of their best players to come back into the fold, that they're further away from it than Kerry are, that they still possibly should have won the game, had the better of the exchanges. And
but it doesn't matter. Clifford's Clifford. The whole of Kerry is going to be like every day getting up going, we have the Messiah. Nothing can stop us.
Well, there is no question about that. There is.
How good was he?
He was unbelievable, Ger. Absolutely unbelievable. There is, like, when he watched Clifford at minor level, there was a slapstick nature to what he was doing because you were like, this guy is clearly amazingly talented, but also he's further developed than some of the other kids who are marking him. He's bigger, he can hold off tackles quite easily. And you're like, well, that's funny. He's not going to do like 4-4 when he gets to senior level. But then he gets to senior level.
And he does.
And now he's started to do this thing where he is looking like a man playing against boys. That goal was
goal
just a situation where he was just like, he plays with a force field around him.
Did he toe poke? Was it a toe poke? I'm not sure I've ever seen it.
No, it was
side foot. Is it side
foot?
Okay. All right. Okay.
But what's
a lot of power for side foot? Like
how many times do you think he uses his right foot in that passage of play? So obviously he's left footed and he scores with his left foot. How many times do you think he uses his right foot?
Twice.
Not a single time.
Really?
I thought to myself, this is amazing two-footed play.
Yeah.
I watched it back, and I was like, actually, that is one of the weirdest left-footed solos I've ever seen. Now, some people say, well, he's clearly favoured onto his left. But that solo, which kind of loops up around and then he kind of takes it back over Owen Merchant's head before finishing, that's a solo with his left foot. And it's just kind of defies all sort of logic when you look at it. It left David Byrne on his belly and Owen Merchant flailing at fresh air. Now, it helps that Owen Merchant is probably the smallest man on the pitch, and he can make that sort of person, that stature, look like they're kind of got a smaller physique than Clifford does. But the point still stands. These are two senior players, two outstanding defenders for Dublin, which he just run rings around, and the finish was brilliant as well. Like, it's you can't really come up with enough superlatives to talk about this guy. The only real questions now is just where his ceiling is at. Like, Dublin is going to be a huge barrier to the overall tally, you'd imagine, of the All-Ireland medals. He's not going to get to
10.
The Spillane's. He's not going to get to the Pat Spillane's level, Paddy O'Shea's level of winning All-Ireland medals. But when you look at it with the naked eye and you compare him to more recent legends, which is Maurice Fitzgerald, Colm Cooper, he might be able to achieve that. You'd certainly expect him to surpass Maurice Fitzgerald's All-Ireland tally. Might not surpass Colm Cooper's tally, but as a player...
What does Cooper have?
We're already... Is it six?
Six.
Five. If we're already... Like, so it would be 04, 06, 07, 09, and then 20. So actually only five. If you include, so it's definitely doable. But what, like, we were talking about this as just a pure talent, as somebody, as one of the greats that we're going to see, you have to be talking about him in that company, potentially exceeding that company as well.
Yeah, but I mean, Maurice Fitz obviously famously doesn't have anywhere near as many All-Ireland medals as those, and yet we consider Maurice Fitz to be the equal of all of those players. So who knows? I'm not going to judge his career in the highlights reel. And already the highlights reel is as good as anybody's. Granted, a lot of those were at schools and underage level, but now he's starting to add highlight reels at the same rate he added them at the schools and underage level against the grown-ups.
And that's the thing.
And like, he hasn't quite got his full man strength yet. Is that a shoulder? Is that strapping on his shoulder that you see underneath the jersey? I wonder, was that the motive to for down the line, let's see what's underneath it.
It even seems that the fabric on his shirt is a bit stronger, because John Small, I'll tell you one thing, did his very best to turn that into a V-neck, and it's still at least maintained its round shape, as you can see there. I don't know how he didn't manage to rip it to pieces.
If I controlled the GAA Museum, I'd be ringing him and I'd be saying, here, listen, we want that jersey.
Yeah.
We want that jersey. We don't want any of the rest of your jerseys for the rest of your career. Just give us that one. And that's
first game as captain,
and also look how ripped it is, and so everybody understands fully that this is what he puts up with in every game.
Yeah, I wouldn't be playing any small violin for David Clifford on that front, though. He's well able to give it back himself. He's well able to look after himself, and that's one thing about these Kerry players over the last 12 months, is that they've started to turn into a team that are able to hold their own. There was a bit of a brawl at the end of the game in Tralee last year, a bit of a brawl at the end of this game. And yet, in the midst of it all, you have Dean Rock coming over, essentially before the full-time whistle is blown, congratulating this kid on kicking the equaliser. There is still a lot of respect there. So I definitely wouldn't be kind of, as I say, feeling sorry
Dean
for
Rock
David
Clifford. Dean Rock wasn't just adding on the extra bit of pressure, was he?
Well, it was afterwards.
Oh,
and
right.
It was after you'd taken the free.
Okay, sorry, I didn't see the end of it.
Because I'd missed it at the time, and I was like, well, that was obviously them just shaking hands at the end of the game. But it was immediately after the free was scored.
Right.
He comes over, gives him a slap in the back and stuff like that. But it was an unbelievable game. I think, like, when you look at someone like Brian Fenton, he is one of those players as well who sort of plays with that force field, and that you have somebody running alongside him but perhaps not making any impact in dispossessing him. And Kieran Kilkenny obviously has that same thing with his low centre of gravity, and he was brilliant once again. I was surprised he did get man of the match. I thought Fenton probably deserved it. Essentially put Dublin into a very commanding position in the first half, and he is doing things that we will not see for a while as well.
Fenton.
Yeah, just because of the athleticism and the way he glides over the ground, it's very unusual.
I was listening to a podcast about Kobe Bryant on the way in, it was Bill Simmons' one, and he was saying that what happens is that you get these standout players in the NBA and everybody defines himself against him. How good am I versus him? And it got me thinking about who are those players in the GAA, and Brian Fenton is really it.
Yeah.
Like, you can't, everybody can measure themselves against the impact that he has in the game. There are other players who are stratospherically gifted and who are brilliant, like Jack McCaffrey, but you wouldn't measure yourself against Jack McCaffrey because it's such a unique skill set that he has. But Fenton does a little bit of what everybody does, and it's a good way of thinking he is actually the stratospheric, he is the current best player in the GAA.
Well, it's him or Clifford, really. And it's,
well, so Clifford's now coming to that point.
Yeah, I was saying at halftime in the game that Fenton is number one. We're actually having a bit of an argument in the stadium. Plenty of my fellow county men were telling me that I was wrong, that Clifford is actually number one. But I still think that Fenton is probably the number one player in the country at the moment, and kind of an unstoppable force. Just one thing, I know we'll get into it with Anthony a little bit later on. The one thing that's kind of going to fly under the radar from the storylines of the last weekend is James O'Donoghue kicking, what, 2 or 3 points? The last time we saw him kickstart a league like that was a few years ago away to Donegal when it looked like he was going to be back, and then he picked up injuries. So I say it every single year, if you put him on ice, if you wrap him in cotton wool, keep him fit, that is the sort of, I don't want to say peripheral talent, but not central talent that could win an All-Ireland or wrestle the, Sam Maguire away from Dublin. That is the importance of which I'd place on him and that forward line. I thought he was excellent.
Yeah. All right, let's get into the newspaper headlines. Back page of the Irish Independent this morning is New Look, Daisha stand their ground. Waterford rediscover identity to leave rebels in the shade. And Dick Clerkin, first weekend shows us why we must not persevere with the advanced mark. They also have Kobe Bryant. Bryant redefined his sport as only a true icon could. And club to stick with kids as Reds are tamed by the Shrews. Clifford shows why Farrell got the captain call wrong. So that's a piece from Eamon Sweeney saying that David Clifford, good captain, therefore Andy Farrell should have picked James Ryan.
Yeah, I think...
A bit early
to be saying that, but I think it's just...
Waterford hurlers, I mean, in fairness, like, if they're back, that's amazing.
It is. I would definitely preach a little bit of caution around Waterford. They got to a league final last year, let's not forget, so they didn't necessarily have a bad spring. But I think you have to be very encouraged by what you've seen. Kind of a different sort of no-nonsense attitude from them this year, which is kind of what they need. No more Mr. Nice Guy is probably the response that Waterford needed.
Look at this. It's like one of those... it's like Guernica, one of those paintings where, you know, there's just bodies lying all over the place. It's a great photograph. And it shows that there's a little bit of bite in some of these league games early on.
Well, there has to be, even from a hurling point of view, where this league is just kind of pointless in certain areas because there is another league coming down the line. At least you're still getting stuff like this. And there was a nice bit of needle in Kilkenny Dublin as well yesterday, which is always good to see. It is the hurling on the front of the Irish Examiner. Comeback Kids is their headline. Cahill's Waterford edge Cork despite nightmare start. Six Shooters is their headline from Croke Park. Dublin and Kerry bosses want extra sub option returned. Colestor Joy is the domestic basketball story. Dubliners delight as Brunel come up shy. Up and comings, Klopp's unbeatables tied up by League One Shrewsbury, and Kobe tragedy. NBA legend Bryant loses his life in Los Angeles helicopter crash.
Some good stories here inside the Star, so I haven't got to the back page yet here, but it's the pullout, the GA pullout. Is this tab of the morning to you? Joyce is right. What are they in for their own?
I would say they're going for the Joyce is right, aka the Price is right. If you put on that particular accent, you'll get it.
Go again?
The Joyce is right.
Right. Legend Porrick is off to a winning start with the Tribe. And then inside they have a match report from Tyrone and Meath and a picture of an interested spectator with the beanie hat on. Do you know who it is?
I haven't seen this, no.
Carl McShane.
Oh, he was at the game.
He's at the game. The manager, Mickey Hart, says, I didn't know he was back from Australia. I'd been talking to him before he went out there and knew he was going out for 10 to 15 days at least. I didn't know he was back and he didn't tell me he had landed back in our world yet. I will be talking to him during the week. All we need to know is the final decision. Is he going to be there for us this year? Or is he going to be in Australia? When he gives us that final decision, we will know where we stand. So,
but I wish him all the best, I'm sure, is what he said at the end after.
Tyrone beat Meath, routine victory, 114 to 19.
The Irish Times this morning leads with Saturday night's encounter. Dublin and Kerry bring the glamour, says Keith Duggan. Testy 80-minute extravaganza leaves rivals all square and hot under the collar. Cahill praises Daisha's character as they claim Rebel's scalp, writes Sean Moran. Lively start to Hurling League as Limerick comeback stuns All-Ireland holders' tip. And Solskjaer enjoys a rare comfortable day at the office as United hit six. Tranmere being put to the sword by the likes of Phil Jones and Jesse Lingard yesterday. And Saudi Wealth Fund close to buying Newcastle, writes Louise Taylor. So this is a shell company. Has been registered to facilitate a potential £340 million takeover of Newcastle by Saudi's sovereign wealth fund. As sources close to the deal claim they are now 90% certain it will succeed.
It's all coming up, Mike Ashley, isn't it? The back page of the Star is Klopp tied. Liverpool boss and his first team squad won't be at FA Cup replay. Jurgen Klopp has revealed neither he nor his Champions League winning stars will be at the Liverpool FA Cup replay, with Shrewsbury saying they must respect the players' welfare. He was unimpressed with their display, where obviously they were 2-0 open and finishes 2-2. The return is scheduled for Tuesday, the 4th of February, and Klopp has already promised the Club World Cup winners a week-long holiday during their agreed winter break. Surely he can go, though. Is that not like... I mean, come on, show up. It's the FA Cup. You have to show up.
You have to show up for that. Even like,
you're not telling the players whatever, but like, you have to be there.
Without question. And he probably, like, I think he's probably getting a bit of a kick out of the situation that they're in, that they are so, so successful in the league, still involved in the Champions League, that they just have to play these very talented kids in the cup competitions. Yesterday wasn't a great result for any Everton fans out there, I'd imagine. The Everton side, who got put to the sword fairly comprehensively by that Liverpool team of kids, who obviously were stopped in their tracks yesterday by Shrewsbury.
Beaten 5-0 by Aston Villa, of course.
Well, absolutely. So Aston Villa look exceptional now.
Yeah, come on.
The Mirror this morning goes with football Muriel. The one thing I couldn't quite tell yesterday is who's got a sleeve tattoo or not, because there was just so much mud on everybody's body, and you couldn't quite tell was it actually ink or mud on the arm of Phil Jones there, for example. 6-0 against Tranmere away. Solskjaer hails his crisis hit Reds as they go mad in the muck to win game. Everybody wanted us to lose. And Klopp on replay, I won't be there and I'll play the kids. I respect the winter break.
Back page of the London Times is, I'll play the kids and replay, says Klopp. So that's that full story there. And apparently Mike Ashley is angry that the fact that he's on the verge of selling out to the Saudis has leaked. Over the next 48 hours, he's going to decide whether or not to accept the offer of 340 million quid. But he's pissed off because it appeared in the Wall Street Journal on Saturday. Sources that claim to have knowledge of the talks revealed he'd already asked for 2 days to consider his options. I mean, you'd be surprised if he didn't take the money and run at this point, right?
Is this what it's all been for? Because in previous situations, you thought to yourself, why doesn't Mike Ashley just save himself the trouble of the fans giving out about him all the time and just get out of the club, make some sort of offer, break even, accept some sort of offer to break even? But now this is like his dreams come true, you'd have thought. Or unless he just really enjoys running Newcastle United, and maybe this is kind of the part of his life that he doesn't want to give up the most. Like, we don't really know for sure what is motivating him. A lot of people still very, very unhappy with how he's run the club. But this would be the perfect get-out clause from Ashley if he was looking for a way out.
She appears to be, because it's been for sale for ages.
The Guardian back page is, we will honour the break. Klopp, Adam and senior players will not feature in Shrewsbury replay. Six appeal is the headline there, beside a picture of Mason Greenwood. Respite for Solskjaer as United thrash Tranmere. High five. Wood works his magic as England close in on series win. And more misery. Saracens end difficult week with heavy loss to Harlequins.
Telegraph, we haven't done that one yet. So, tamed by the shrews. Surely that's Tower of the Morning to you, right? Tamed by the shrews?
Yes, I would have thought so.
Yeah.
Well, like, I mean, is that Tower of the Morning to you, or is it Football Muddy Hell Tower of the Morning to you?
Football Muddy Hell is more in keeping with the, oh wow, the Shrewsbury guy has a tattoo of Joker on his left thigh. It's not the Joaquin Phoenix one. It's the one, you can't really see that from that distance before that.
It's Heath Ledger.
Heath Ledger, yeah.
At least it's not Jared Leto. That would have just been...
I didn't even know Jared Leto. I haven't seen that movie.
Don't.
Is it awful?
Yes.
Right. Is it awful? I mean, is it that bad?
Well, I would say in the context of Phoenix and Ledger, you're in a fairly difficult position to impress as Joker. Granted, he was probably the second of the three. But no, don't watch it. I think he's... I would go along with, he's picked the best Joker to put on his tie. You know, there'll be a lot of Joaquin Phoenix fans out there who'll say, actually the second best. But no, I think he's picked the best Joker version, to be honest.
Have you totally just casting Jack Nicholson aside?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, I have actually. I haven't seen it in a long, long time in Paris.
That's the one that everybody...
Maybe need to watch it back in my adult life. I think you're probably clinging to nostalgia there.
No, it's amazing. And Heart and Dark. Sorry, I skipped you there. The old switch and bait and switch. Heart and Dark. Tyrone Boss is unsure of Starman's Oz plans because he didn't know he was on the touchline or on the stand watching him. The terrace is watching him even, and doesn't know what he's going to do. So Tyrone were good though, weren't they? Dispatch me in a routine manner. That's like a stereotypical Tyrone performance over the last 2 decades.
Well, it's their easiest fixture of Division 1 this year. Like, if they, you have to be beating Meath at home.
Yeah, but are Meath actually not going to be a reasonable Division 1 team this year, because they're one of the teams who are going to be putting a lot of store in it? No?
I think on the evidence of the rest of the weekend, everybody's putting a lot of store in Division 1. I don't think anybody goes in with the attitude of not trying to win the league at the moment. Like, you saw the scenes as well in Ballybofey on Saturday night. Like, the standard is right there. There's, like, a couple of... I want to say the sharpness is off at the moment in the Football League. We saw it as well in Croke Park on Saturday. But the fitness doesn't seem to be off at all. Like, the only kind of signs of anybody being... away from the football pitch for quite some time is actually Aidan O'Shea sporting the best tan I've ever seen on a football pitch ever, clearly back from Asia over the last couple of weeks. None of the Dublin or Kerry players have managed to rack up that much of a tan.
Do you think they're like, listen lads, make sure you cover up there, a lot of sunscreen, make sure no one thinks
of it. I think you've got a flaunt it. I think if you're going all the way to Asia, you've got to come back with something, and I think a fine tan is one of those things. So no, I think people have enjoyed their winters as they've always done in the past, but they don't quite enjoy it just like that. And I think some of the training that might have been done over the last couple of weeks was horrific. People want to win the National League. It's as simple as that. And if you're coming up to Division 1 as me there, possibly the outsider of the entire division.
So you think straight back down?
I would have thought so. Like, if you're making a prediction for the league, you would have thought that they'd be prime candidates to go back down. That being said, like, you'd be looking at Tyrone minus Colin McShane and be thinking a similar thing as well. But at home yesterday, they got the job done. The back page of the Irish Sun this morning is Shrew 2, Jason Smile High Club, and two fingers to FA Cup. Klopp won't boss in replay, and Liverpool will field team of kids. Rafa Benitez, meanwhile, is being targeted to make a stunning return as Newcastle manager. This is part of the potential takeover at St James's Park. Refs left in limbo, writes John Fallon. The FAI was thrown into further chaos last night as it emerged that 40% of League of Ireland referees did not pass fitness tests. And wide of the mark is the hurling headline here. Kilkenny's doubters were way off yet again as they sank Dublin in their NHL Division 1 opener. They hammered Dublin yesterday despite a sending off.
All right, are we done with the papers? Are we going to do the Irish news? Have we got the Irish news? Yeah, we do, yeah. So Tally laments a lack of cutting edge from Down. Slow start to the league for Down. McCurry fires up Tyrone. Down ended up drawing with Tip. And Paddy Heaney returns to the Irish News. So that's their own story about themselves there on that. Which Paddy Heaney, great writer. So worth digging out. Right, it is 8 minutes past eight this Monday morning. We're turning to Kobe Bryant's death before 9 o'clock, a little bit later on, with Ryan Farmer-Jones, editor emeritus of Slam Magazine, and Jason Sherlock. First, though, let's hear from the LA Clippers coach, Doc Rivers, speaking overnight.
I have it. Listen. You know, I don't know. You know, I just don't have a lot to say. The news is just devastating to everybody who knew him, known him a long time. And, you know, he means a lot to me, obviously. You know, he was such a great opponent, you know. It's what you want in sports. He had that DNA that very few athletes can ever have, you know, the Tiger Woods and the Michael Jordans.
Doc Rivers there reacting to the news of Kobe Bryant's death in a helicopter crash. More on that for you a little bit later on. It's 10 minutes past 8 here this morning on OTBAM. Now, the league's kicked off on Saturday night with a brilliant draw in Croke Park. Here's the new Dublin boss, Desi Farrell, chatting with Jamie after Dublin's 1-19 draw against Kerry.
With Dublin manager Desi Farrell. Desi, your first game on the sideline as senior manager at Croke Park, a 1-19-all draw against Kerry, 40,000 crowd. What did you make of it?
Yeah, it was a highly competitive game. Great start to the National League campaign. Both teams went at it in proper fashion, and we're delighted with the result.
If you could have wished for, you know, a better test on your opening night at Croker in terms of what Kerry would bring, the crowd, the atmosphere, the game, how it went, that you had to equalise and then they equalised in the last minute, could you have kind of written down on paper more of a test than that?
No, definitely not. You're right in at the deep end with this one, and And we knew Kerry coming to Croke Park were going to be very, very competitive, as they were. And just delighted with how our boys performed. They were only back 2 weeks or so, and there's plenty of work to be done for sure. But the effort tonight was fantastic from the lads.
What do you think when Dean Rock scores that free in the 6 minute of injury time to win it? We thought, I had my report written for full time on a win, and then the referee adds three more minutes and Kerry equalised then literally with their last kick.
Yeah, that's the type of game it was, and it sort of, as we came into it in the last period, you know, you just got a sense it was going to go down to the wire, and that's what happened.
This is Farrell chatting with Jamie Moore in the aftermath of the game. Anthony Moyes is with us this morning. Anthony, how are you?
Morning, Ger. How are you doing?
It's about David Clifford, though, isn't it? That's what we should be talking about this morning, because we were saying earlier on that he's got highlights reels where he does this in Croke Park against kids and he like looks like a grown-up, but he's doing it now against grown-ups when he is a grown-up.
Yeah, and I felt sorry for Davey Byrne. Like, he wasn't actually having a bad first 20-25 minutes on him. Like, he took him on at one stage about 4 or 5 minutes before that, and he actually did really well. He stood him up and did really well and got a great block, you know, and kind of looked like he's, you know, as a defender, you're like, yes,
I'm in now.
Just go again. Next one down, that's all I need, you know, because you'll really only get tested 3 or 4 times in a game one-on-one like that where you potentially get exposed. But the goal was just unbelievable.
Do you just make an acceptance that you're going to concede 5 to 7 points against him from play, and that if you come in on the right side of that, well done? Is that how you manage this?
I think it is. Yeah, I think it is. And I think you have to. I remember we played Kildare and I was marking Johnny Doyle, and Doyle was absolutely flying at the time. Johnny was flying, and I remember just thinking to myself, if I can get away with 6 to 8 all in,
freeze,
I said, I'll have a decent enough day. Now, if you said that about a normal forward, you'd be like, you get roasted.
Yeah.
You know, but you have to kind of just say, okay, he is going to get. And like, it's funny, we get into the game in a minute, but the ball in from O'Shea was absolutely beautiful to him. It was just one of those balls where as a defender you say, oh, I can get this. And then it just starts to drift and drift and drift. And if you notice, like, Clifford takes it on his right side and is able to just roll Byrne, and then from that day he's struggling. He was always kind of trying to catch up, and as soon as he went to ground, that was it, you know, he just had him. But he still had loads to do.
No, yeah, but even the finish is amazing.
Oh yeah, like Evan Comerford is like he's turned into a beast, you know. Like, I mean, you see him, you know, compared to even to last year in the league where he looked slight. Like, the fella has put on size, very agile. His kickouts were good, although Kerry after a while just kind of gave him the short kick out. But yeah, Clifford is just, and the free at the end was absolutely ridiculous. Like, I mean, most fellas would say, geez, I'm just going to sneak this over the black spot, whereas he absolutely minced it, you know, and put like just beautiful curl on it. It was just like, yeah, okay.
It's something as well that you see Dean Rock coming over and congratulating him. Like, yeah. I hate this phrase, classy touch. That's often used too much in sports circles at the moment, but that was a classy touch.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. Like, I mean, Rock could obviously, you know, kind of empathise with the pressure of it and everything else, and obviously the execution of it. But he's, like, it's funny, you know, over the game, I thought O'Shea, the clash of head seemed to affect O'Shea, I thought, early on, because he wasn't really in the game for the first 15, 20 minutes. And they definitely need him kind of rolling, because I think Geaney was really lost yesterday. There's a lot of pluses for Kerry. Like, O'Donoghue was a massive plus for Kerry. Massive plus for Kerry, because he kicked some absolutely beautiful scores too.
Where was Clifford playing?
He was playing inside. But Tommy Walsh was really your Tommy Walsh, I thought they played Tommy Walsh really well. I thought Tommy Walsh gave Philly McMahon a really tough time.
He was he's like Dave McGoldrick. He's your nine, drops deep, holds onto the ball, get runners off Tommy Walsh's shoulder, and you're in a great position.
That's all it was. And they never actually managed to ping one to him where you could catch it on his chest and mark it. It was all just popped in front. You
so
know?
Hang on. So they've got four up front.
Well, Geaney was kind of more out at 11.
Right.
And O'Shea then was kind of drifting out around midfield. Yeah, and when Spillane, I think Kerry have probably decided that Spillane is the man for Fenton. You know, he's done relatively well against him, and they said, but he got a pretty bad injury, it looked like. And it was funny, I thought Kerry, like, I know it's only the league, and people say, but if you actually really analyse, if this was Championship, I don't think too many people would be pretty happy with Keane, because they left Spillane on for about probably 9, 10, 11 minutes. I actually couldn't believe when I saw him being taken off. And that was the spell where Dublin really pushed on. I think Dublin went 4 or 5 ahead. And effectively, Kerry were playing with 14 men. Yeah. You know, but they left him on, obviously, to try and see could he run it off. But he was in a bad way from the minute one where he got the injury. O'Shea then kind of ended up taking Fenton. And I think it probably wasn't the best use of his ability, because Fenton decided, well, I'm gonna, especially in that little spell, like he had a spell, the three scores he kicked in a row were just equally as ridiculous as Clifford's goal.
This is, I think, something that's a huge issue for Kerry. It's this legacy issue of Mark O'Connor going down under, who is going to be the next midfield superstar that they have, who will be David Moran's partner. So this is a great opportunity for them to test it out, because Moran's out for the league. They had two of the candidates playing club actions, and they were out in Dermot O'Connor and Jack Barry. But I think what Saturday night hammered home was that if you can't find a candidate to partner David Moran, Sean O'Shea might by default become that midfielder. And he's just
can't,
not...
You can't do that. You can't find Peter to pay Paul.
Exactly. And I think that makes the issue even more pressing for Kerry.
Yeah, and I think it really robs them. Because I think Gainey is so used to being inside and doing what he does that when he's out in that bit of space, he's kind of caught between... You know, he loves to pivot and just take it. And he's caught between whether he passes, whether he runs. Whereas O'Shea naturally knows, once he gets the ball, he knows I'm either taking you on or he pings a pass in that he gave to Clifford. Like, he just saw the space in front. It was outside of his right boot. Just a beautiful pass into him. And he really came into the game. I do think he was a bit affected. For that 15, 20 minutes, Kerry were poor. But then once he kind of started to get on the ball, and once Clifford got on the ball, Kerry started to roll. I have to say, I liked some of the new guys from Kerry were good. The young O'Brien lad, I thought, had a decent outing. Like, he's a big unit. He's a guy who they'll need for an extra kick out. I thought Ryan did really well in goals. Bit disappointed with some of the defending, I have to say. Like, I think Enright fouled a number of times again in vital times, not only the one for Kilkenny at the end to put them ahead, but even the goal, like, Obiugli was a bit rash. I thought Ryan was well out and had that covered, and I just thought he jumped in a bit. But, you know, they'll both be happy, Ger. Fenton was absolutely not, like, for a 15 minute spell around the goal, around the scores. Now, he kind of died a little bit after that, but the points he kicked were just, and it was a real one of these. The Clifford goal had just gone in, and it was real kind of like, just give me the ball.
Yeah.
I'm going to do something here for us. And it was a real sign of leadership. You know, it was just like, I'm going to get it. I'm going to step inside and bang it over the bar.
They put Clifford in the 14 jersey. I don't know if it's superstition or not, because the 13. Like, or is he actually going to play 14 this year? Is that the intention? It's hard. Like, who are the corner forwards in this? Do they have corner forwards? We don't really do that anymore. It doesn't really matter. But is he actually now just going to be a full forward?
It might be the superstition. Like, I mean, why mess with it? You know, like, whether you're into it or whether you're not into it, why mess with it? So just give him the 14. You know, like, but Tommy Walsh was, I thought he played, like, a lot of people would say, well, you know, he didn't really, and he hit a bad one in the second half where he dropped it into Comfort's hands. Remember when actually they were streaking a little bit ahead. There was two in a row. Clifford had one and Tommy Walsh had one.
Tommy Walsh in the full forward line for the whole game.
Drifted. And he just sat in with Philly McMahon, and Philly McMahon had a really tough day. Like, it was strange to get on to Dublin. I thought... But I'm just get back to your point. So Clifford most certainly he's allowed obviously drift. O'Donoghue, I thought, was more their focal point of say coming around Tommy Walsh. Tommy Walsh wins it, flicks it. O'Donoghue's coming around the corner, very, very difficult to stop.
Yeah.
He looked really good. I haven't seen him looking as fit in a long time. His movement was excellent. He gave Merchant as a really torrid time. Like, he didn't know where he was. He was standing off him. He didn't get too close. When he got close, he skinned them. And they actually doubled him so much that they pulled him off him in the second half, and they moved Merchant out to the half-back line.
Taylor's on his 29. He won't be 30 until, I just checked it there, until June. Like, still a young man, you know?
But
no miles on the clock.
It's a massive bonus for them this year. Like, Spillane, I think, is excellent. But I just don't think he gives you... Like, O'Donoghue has that ability, obviously, off his left or right.
Yeah.
And he can kick a long-range score. Like, he hit a couple of rakers the other night. And he's just busy, you know. And he also brings guys in. His vision is excellent. They were good. I thought Kerry were impressive. A little bit rash and a little bit... ill-disciplined in their defence.
The black card kind of illustrated that as well.
Yeah, yeah. And midfield, obviously. But as you say, a number of guys out, and then Spillane getting that injury didn't help them.
This time last year, I would not have felt that they were realistic contenders because I didn't think they had the strength and depth. And it turned out I was completely wrong because they should have won the All-Ireland the first day. This year, I'm 100% convinced that they are absolutely legitimate contenders. Not just because the Dubs are coming off five in a row, but because they had that experience. They've gone so close. Everybody's a year older and a year wiser. They've potentially a solution at centre-back to come back whenever the ACL clears up. And you're like, why wouldn't they be? Like, I think they're right there with the Dubs.
Well, the thing that kind of struck me, if you're looking at the difference between the two, OK, Dublin didn't have, you know, Conor Callaghan and Mannion came on. And I kind of got the sense that McMenamin and Paddy Andrews started not to kind of say this is last chance saloon, but certainly to kind of go, OK, we're going to give you a bit of game time to really show, OK? And neither of them had a great game, OK? So I'd say Dublin are in a situation where if you weigh them up, like Kerry have some seriously now really, really good talented forwards, and all of them can hurt you. Mm. You know, O'Shea can hurt you, Clifford can hurt you, O'Donoghue can hurt you, Gainey can hurt you, Tommy Walsh can hurt you in a different way, O'Brien will hurt you. So all of them can kick scores. You've got definitely five out of the six that you could pick who you'll know will get on the score sheet. I don't really think Dublin have that at the moment. Like Scully, every now and again, you know, Kilkenny ended up getting three, but for large periods of the game, Kilkenny was well marshalled, I thought. You know, he came really into it at the end. He did his usual kind of just that kind of quarterback role across the pitch, you know, linking play. But, you know, you've Mannion, you've O'Callaghan. They definitely need someone like that guy McHugh now from the Fianna to step up. I think they need something different in that full forward line. They need a lad who's strong enough to win his own ball turn, which he did. He kicked a beautiful score, won a ball, turned onto his left foot, banged it over the bar. But I thought Morley got a handle on him then and put him kind of... He ended up getting taken off, not because he was playing bat poorly, but I definitely think Dublin and Farrell needs to unearth another real threat in that scoring forward, like a la Bernard Brogan. He needs to get someone. Costello obviously will come back, but you don't know where is he going to be. Is he going to stay? Is he going to really push ahead, you know, from last year?
Do you fast track a Kieran Archer potentially into the setup?
I think you do, but if you are, you better get him in the league. You know, I think you have to give him game time. You have to try to give him at least 3 to 4 starts. Listen, there's loads of talent there. Like, the actual lad who came on, Byrne, I thought was really good. Like, he really stretched Kerry in the last 10 minutes. And I thought he kicked a good score. And he actually looked really lively, very fast, very confident on the ball. Big lad. Notwithstanding the fact that he looks like Prince Harry, there's plenty of slagging going on. But I actually think he was really, really good. And he's a fella who actually might get a start the next day. But it's just, like, Kerry just have the natural forwards, and everyone would always say that. But it's the defence that they need to tighten up a little bit, Ger. And I think it's this needless fouling, I think, sometimes that goes on. You know, where they are there, they have numbers, and there's a rash hand in. Or, you know, and then a guy's hitting the deck. And if you give 4, 5, 6 of those away in a game, that all adds up. Hmm. You know, Dublin very rarely do that. They just very rarely do it. You know, they create the arc. They make you try to play around them or through them. And they don't give handy ones away, you know.
You must feel pretty confident. You're trying to... I can see you, like, trying to dim... keep the excitement levels down. But you're like... You're up to high now.
But it's kind of an intangible thing, isn't it? The whole how do Kerry get cuter question. Because I think they've come a hell of a long way in that period of time that we've seen under Peter Keane so far. But there is still that element of the frustration of Shane Enright looking up at the big screen at the end and thinking, oh God, was that actually a foul? Was it a soft free? Perhaps they shouldn't be in those sort of positions. But then, like, at the same time, I guess these are humans playing football. You see Niall Scully booting the ball away to give David Clifford the yards at the end. There has to be some sort of allowance for your failings in that department every day. But I just come back to this midfield point. It is the single most important position that Kerry needs on earth this year.
But Jack Barry's going to be fine, no?
He should be. I mean, he's always good. He's always great against Dublin, actually. He loves playing against Dublin, Jack Barry. So that works out pretty well. But I don't know why Gavin O'Brien didn't get more game time last summer. I don't know what the situation was there because I thought he was good again on Saturday night. But you have to be confident. Like, I think that they are unquestionably the number two team in the country. But how big a win would have been on Saturday night, I think, is
yeah,
thing.
You know, and I thought coming into the final stages, they would have seen it out. Mm. And that, again, you have to tip the hat to Dublin. Like, I mean, Dublin looked dead and buried, you know, down to 14. You're kind of saying, ah, Kerry will see this out and they'll win by one or two. But yet Dublin found a way. You know, yeah. They came up, McCarthy comes up, gets a great score. And they just started to squeeze, and they really squeezed the kick out. Ryan found it hard to get it out. And they started to come. And again, you know, like, I mean, I go back to Fenton, but McCarthy was absolutely fantastic again. John Small was very, very solid at six. I thought Davy Byrne was decent at three.
Yeah.
You know, I thought he's a guy who just goes and just does his job. Funny, at one stage he actually managed to come out with the ball, and he was kind of away from Clifford, and he had green grass in front of him. But he just kind of, he came to a certain line, he just stopped, and he just hand passed the ball. It was like, it wasn't like Philly or Cooper who would keep going. He just went, no, I'm going back into this guy.
Yeah.
So he knows his job, he knows his role, and, you know, he does it very well.
Do they need more defenders, though? Like, I know that you're making the point about they need attackers, but so they do have a wealth of attacking talent to come back in, and maybe it's a system that provides those scores as opposed to...
Yeah.
An individual kicking 10 points, because we haven't even talked about Connolly yet, and like he's still knocking about.
That's
so
true. Yeah.
But the defenders have been growing old together. Like, I don't know if there's been some Merchant is there thereabouts in the team, but it's a sub at half time last year in the big game. Like, nobody has burst their way into that starting six and gone, okay, I'm now a defender for the ages who's going to be here for a couple of years.
Yeah, like Lowndes was quiet, I felt. And well, Davy Byrne, I think, you know, if you throw Fitzsimons and you throw Cooper back into the mix, and Keane O'Sullivan, wherever, you know, whenever and however he is.
Yeah.
You know, Rory O'Carroll doesn't seem to have been able to make that impression,
yeah.
You know, that says, give me that number three jersey.
He's still there.
He's still there. Yeah, no, he is still there. And look, after, you know, he's missed a bit of time, he obviously has to prove himself to get back in. But it's you know, his free was a bit rash at the end. I think James O'Donoghue will be very, very happy with his night's work. Like, he got 50 minutes. I was surprised he actually took him off that early. I thought they'd give him a little bit more, because I thought Merchant would have marked up really well on him. Right, but it was amazing. Like, I mean, it seemed that Dublin defenders were kind of marking from behind. You know, there wasn't, like, I mean, the Kerry guys were winning the ball well out in front, and with space. You know, from there was separation between them and the Dublin guys. And I don't know if this was a concern about the mark, but you know, it's they probably need to get one or two unearthed. But I don't think they're in that bad of trouble at the defence.
Okay. Surely Kerry's game management is a big issue after the weekend, says Jack Queeley on Twitter. Three up, a man up with 10 minutes to go, and they still couldn't close off the game. It is like the greatest team of all time they're up against, though. Right?
But so. He's right, though, in what he says. Like, that, it is just that street smartness, which I think they do have a bit of a journey still to go. Like you mentioned the attacking mark there. It's not something that I think McHugh caught a nice one just before halftime, and that was kind of the only real evidence we saw of it changing the way the teams played on Saturday night.
Yeah.
But I think if you looked at the other game on Saturday night, and you look at Ballybofey, I think it was a vast change in how Mayo are approaching this year. I watched the full thing back last night, and it was just long ball after long ball after long ball. Some of them were terrible balls. Cullen Boyle completely missed every human being by about 20 yards from those balls. But it just suggests something. What is the one thing that Mayo actually have that other teams don't have? They've got a lot of big men.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I would not be surprised to see Aidan O'Shea, Seamus O'Shea, Tom Parsons spend a lot of time at 14 this year, because they were pumping the ball in long. It was like Jack O'Connor and Kieran Donaghy in 2006. That's what Mayo were like on Saturday night.
Yeah, just put it in there. And it's, you know, I don't know, from the Dublin game, Dublin just, it was like, well, we're not going to even worry about this. Like, they just played the game, like, as if they just didn't care. Even when guys were catching, like, Dean Rock caught one that kind of came across the pitch. It was definitely more than 20 metres, and he caught it, and he turned inside, and he slipped the pass. He never even thought about putting his hand up. And it would have been an easy free for him. But the chance was we actually might get a goal on this. And I think that's the way a lot of people and a lot of teams are actually just approaching it. Bar, as you rightly say, Mayo, who probably say, well, actually, we have the ammunition and we have the personnel to really make use of this and use this to our advantage. But I think it's shocking. I think it's absolutely shocking.
I mean, if you've got a good free taker, stick them out left half forward, right half forward, whichever they're happy kicking from, and just get the ball over the other side of the pitch and just like you saw the little chip shot that
Murphy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, but it was obvious that that was going to be. It was the most obvious. Yeah. It was like once there's a line, and if you're kicking, it, like it's a really easy thing to do. Eventually, yeah. the teams are just going to start. You run two players whose job it is to run across that 40 and make sure they're the right side of it. So long as they can kick the ball from the 40 in, like, isn't that a really good thing for a team to do?
You see, the thing about the change is, not only is it a change for, say, the person receiving the ball, right? But it's also a change of the mindset of the person obviously delivering the ball. So a lot of guys in the last number of years have been told, especially when you get it around half-back midfield or even cornerback, you know, get it out as quick as you can, exit out of your defence at breakneck pace, give a hand pass, get it back, and don't go down the middle, go to the wings to come back in. That's the general way, you know. So run away from the centre, go to the wing, and then someone else can come at an angle and take it off you. So now they're having to think, if I'm doing this, I now actually have to get my head up to deliver a pass. So there's a complete change there of mindset and of obviously skill required. And it's those closer in ones where, say, the likes of, you know, O'Shea and me, I was probably disappointed with Gainey, but the guys who can get on the ball and who can just pop those little 25, 30 yard passes onto the chest, which is all you need when you're a bit more advanced up the pitch. And for a defender, like, it's funny, everyone's saying I was about the Aussie rules. Defenders are going to have to learn that. See, if you were marking, I can imagine the Mayo fullback marking Murphy. All Murphy has to do is get physical with you, push you off, give you a shove, and then so you're 2 yards back and he just comes out and he looks like he's 6-7 yards ahead of you and just claims the ball well ahead of you because you're never going to get around them at that stage. It's exactly like in Aussie rules. At the time when I played Aussie rules, I did a lot with Donaghy in training. And Donaghy was a bigger man than me, heavier than me, much more, you know, kind of stronger than me, and obviously from basketball. And I remember we were training in Westminster. And he cleaned me. He caught about 3 or 4 easy marks over my head and out in front of me. And I said, I can't. I didn't know how to play him. I was playing from the front. They'd put it in over my head. I was playing from behind. I couldn't get a fist on it. So I realised that actually I had to just get, as he moved towards me, I needed to move away from him as well. So I needed a little bit of separation from him all the time, all the while marking him from the front. So if the ball did get short, I was able to get out in front.
So he can't get physical with you.
Exactly. So I took the chance of him grabbing me away. And defenders are actually going to have to do that, especially if this comes in, which, you know, bar special congress or something, that it's in. Defenders can't possibly, you know, you can't go the old ways of, I'm going to get physical with him, especially if you're on a bigger man. Because all he has to do is literally just push you away, which is not a free in Gaelic, and certainly
no one gives
umpires aren't going to get it. So he just pushes you away in the chest or to the side and then it's gone. And all he needs is that 2 or 3 yards and it's an easy pop pass and bang.
Yeah.
So if it's used to an advantage, as you say, rather than the old way of the Gaelic way would be you lump it in and we all jump in the air and see who catches it. That's the wrong way to use the mark.
It's get your free taker out at the half forward spot. So he's running, he's got a corridor that he runs and never leaves that corridor. And he's going to kick 5 or 6 points.
Yeah.
Because everybody's job is to get. When you're saying that the game, they're going to have to get their head up, maybe you don't even have to get. You have two people who are running along the midfield whose job it is to do that. So everybody else still has the same job. There's designated kickers whose job it is to kick the ball to whoever the free taker is.
Well, you can imagine also if I'm coming forward and Owen is that man, he comes out on a loop and comes past me, I just pop the ball to him and as he comes around, his ball is just bang, deliver.
Yeah.
And he just delivers it, cross field or whatever it is, and in as soon as you get it.
My thing is that if I'm a coach of a team who isn't one of the top teams, I'm trying to be the one who breaks the system first. But do I do it in the league and show everybody my hand, or do I wait until the championship comes and do it then?
Well, I certainly think you'll probably have to do it. You'll have to try it out in the big time, you know, last 2 games or something like that. You'll have to be gearing up towards it because it's not something that you can just flick a switch.
You're obviously doing training.
You're going to have to get
the guys. Don't show it.
Yeah, but, you know, if it's done well. Like, there is a difference. Okay, so both sides of the ball, as people talk about, there's going to have to be alterations. And certainly in the full back line, there's going to have to be alterations. And that's why I just felt that the Dublin backs were kind of saying, well, you know, we're not going to get caught in behind here. you know, we'll deal with anything out front. And there wasn't much man marking. You know, so a lot of defenders in the past or now are obviously marking from the front.
Yeah.
And a lot of the Dublin players have marked from the front because they know that, well, everything is going to be here. We'll pull out, we'll get it, and we'll be off at the gap. And we're okay with Cluxton in behind because you can come and grab anything that's hanging in the air. And there definitely seems to be a little bit of a, well, we're not going to stand here, we're going to move back in behind defenders. Because right. A lot of the Kerry guys, as I say, were getting ball relatively easy.
And they can't catch it. OK, a quick word about Tyrone and Meath. Tyrone obviously had Colm McShane in the stands on the terraces watching the game. And we don't know what's going to happen. It's very exciting to see if he's going to come back or not or go to Australia. It's one of the great subplots of the off-season, is now rumbling on into the actual season itself. From Meath's perspective, they kind of need to get a win on the board fairly early on in the league. I actually thought that Meath were going to stay up because they've so much to benefit from staying up that they were going to put a lot into it. But
They are putting a lot into it. You know, there's no doubt about it. I think they've put a lot into it. I think they had a great start. I wasn't at the game, but I was talking to a number of people who were. I was listening to it. First 20, 25 minutes, they should have had 3 goals. They got 1. And you just can't do that. And like, I'm not just saying, you know, 3 goals, like just, yeah. Like, I mean, they should have had 3 goals. Tyrone had got 1. They got 1. And, you know, as we all know, once you go behind against Tyrone, and it goes from 1 point to 3 points, you may as well be 6 points behind because you're now facing into a second half where they've, you know, really going to say, well, we're going to counter-attack you. It's up to you to come break us down, which was a problem. They lost Andy Colgan before the game, which, like, goalkeeper at this stage and in Division 1 is just so unbelievably vital that if you lose your main guy, Dominic York, a replacement goalkeeper, came in and he got taken off at half-time and Barry Dardis had to go in. And Barry Dardis has plays forward for Summerhill. He has played in goals in the past, but they lost 4 of their kickouts in the first half. They lost 8 of their kickouts in the second half.
Yeah,
they got 5 scores directly from kickouts to run, and they won by 5 points.
Yeah,
so you get 2 goals potentially you don't score, and you give 5 scores away. No, I'm not saying, you know, obviously
sure,
things
the
happen.
The game happens. Yeah,
but it's it wasn't ideal.
Yeah.
So like, I mean, you probably say, Jesus, of all the things that could go wrong, that's probably, you know. But at the same time, I think they showed up relatively well. And Tyrone would be in fine fettle. Obviously, they're missing a few. But it was a pity. It would have been a good win to get, although it's never easy up there.
No, definitely not. I think that's the intention of it.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. 8:37 here this morning. Nick Kyrgios and Rafa Nadal have started against each other in the Australian Open. Kyrgios, massive NBA fan, walked out wearing a Kobe Bryant jersey. That's him this morning. Last night, Neymar scored for PSG and paid tribute to Kobe, I think with his second goal, actually, the number 24. Obviously, Tiger Woods has also paid tribute to Kobe Bryant. Woods speaking after finishing his final round at the Farmers Insurance at Torrey Pines, where he finished in a tie for 9th. It's unbelievable, the reality that he's no longer here. They actually told him in the middle of his round as well. I just can't imagine what the entire family's going through right now. It's shocking. When he retired, we'd work out at Equinox together. I was always getting up early. He'd get up early. We'd work out. We really connected on more the mental side of it, the prep, how much it takes to be prepared. More of that story on offtheball.com. We'll be coming back to the story of Kobe Bryant's death with Ryan Farmer-Jones before 9 o'clock. Right now, we're going to hear from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, NBA Hall of Famer and a former Lakers star, reacting to the news of Kobe's death.
It's very difficult for me to put in words how I feel about the loss of Kobe Bryant. As a young boy, I met him when he was 11 or 12 years old. I was friends with his dad, Joe. We were former adversaries. Joe played for the 76ers, but he was a good friend and someone that I shared a friendship. And it's hard for me to understand now how this is affecting Joe and his wife. So to Kobe's family, I want to send my most sincere and heartfelt regrets and prayers, and my thoughts are with you guys. Kobe was an incredible family man. He loved his wife and daughters. He was an incredible athlete and a leader in a lot of ways. He inspired a whole generation of young athletes. He was one of the first ones to leave high school and come to the NBA and do so well, dominating the game
and becoming one of the best scorers that the Los Angeles Lakers has ever seen. I had the privilege of being there when he scored his 81-point game, and it was something that I will always remember as one of the highlights of the things that I have learned and observed in sports. Kobe, my thoughts are with you. Absolutely. Rest in peace, young man. This loss is, it's just hard to comprehend. Go with God.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, of course, himself a very famous Laker in his time, talking about the impact that Kobe Bryant had. Tom Malone is here to give us the sport news, Tom.
Yeah, obviously going to start with Kobe Bryant, as the tributes have been pouring in for the former NBA star who died yesterday in a helicopter crash in California. The 41-year-old, a five-time NBA champion with the Lakers, considered to be one of the all-time greats of the sport. It's reported that nine people were killed when the aircraft came down, including Bryant's 13-year-old daughter, Gianna. And Kavitha Davidson spoke to Off the Ball a little earlier on about Kobe and his legacy.
You know, if you've already developed a fandom, you have these preconceived notions of who this person and this player is as a human being. And the fact that those two things are not always reconciled is really difficult to deal with. When I first heard of Kobe Bryant's death today, and I don't say this lightly, it reminded me a lot of the day that Michael Jackson died. I remember exactly where I was, and I remember the minute by minute breakdown of how I found out, initially not believing it, and then going throughout the course of the day and watching the domino effect. You know, I was in Columbus Circle in New York City, and on the streets of Manhattan, you heard and you saw people get the phone call and get the text message. And the exact same thing happened in LA today. And I talked to more than one fan who, unprompted, brought up that comparison as well. And just as, you know, there are certain people who die and you remember where you were when you heard about them dying, Michael Jackson and Kobe Bryant were two of those people. I think similarly, we struggle with how much we love these two people and how big of fans we are of these two people's work with what we know of them as people and what they may have done off the court and outside of the recording studio.
Yeah, just it's unbelievable last night. And I got home from here just to see that news break. It was really surreal, wasn't it? Anyway, let's move on to golf. Rory McIlroy finished in a tie for third at the Farmers Insurance Open at Torrey Pines yesterday evening. The results means the Down man missed out on the chance to move top of Golf World's rankings. Australian Mark Leishman won that tournament by a shot and 15 under par, one ahead of Spain's John Rahm. And then McIlroy in a tie for third. In football, Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp wants the Premier League and FA Cup organisers to get together and find a solution for fixture congestion. The European champions were held to a 2-2 draw by third-tier Shrewsbury in the fourth round of the Cup yesterday, so we'll need a replay at Anfield during the winter break. Klopp says he and his first team will not be part of that game.
They ask us for respecting the winter break, organizing no international friendlies or competitive games. So we do that. We respect the winter break. So we will be in the winter break, and in 2 weeks' time, our youngsters will play against Shrewsbury at Anfield.
Meanwhile, former Republic of Ireland manager Brian Kerr looks set for a return to the FAI as part of the association's football management committee. The 66-year-old hasn't been involved since exiting his first team boss back in 2005, but reports this morning suggest that Kerr is close to agreeing a new role. It's understood Kerr is close to the new FAI president, Jerry McEnany, who was elected to the post at Saturday's EGM in Dublin. Well, Manchester United boss Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has explained why he ordered Mason Greenwood to take the penalty yesterday. The youngster took the ball off Jesse Lingard to net the final goal in their 6-0 FA Cup victory over Tranmere. That strike also made him become the youngest United player to get to 10 goals since Norman Whiteside. And Solskjaer felt it was good for the 18-year-old's development.
I'd say the first 15-20 minutes, maybe this was a culture shock for Mason, because it's a different kind of football than what he's used to. And I think it's about trying to give him that responsibility and ownership.
Well, elsewhere yesterday, Manchester City got the better of 10-man Fulham by 4-0. Draw for the fifth round takes place this evening just before the all-top flight clash between Bournemouth and Arsenal. And finally, in tennis, Nick Kyrgios has taken to the Rod Laver Arena in his Kobe Bryant jersey in tribute to the basketball great. Top seed Rafael Nadal is taking on Kyrgios in the fourth round of the Australian Open this morning. They're in the early stages of that game, all going with serve thus far. Earlier in the men's singles, Gael Monfils was knocked out in straight sets by Dominic Thiem, while 2014 champion Stan Wawrinka got the better of fourth seed Daniil Medvedev in five sets to reach the quarters.
Wimbledon champion Simona Halep is through to the women's draw after a straight sets win over Belgium's Elise Mertens, while Gabin Muguruza is also through to the last eight, while right now Kerber and Pavlyuchenkova are on court. The Russian is a break up there in the first set.
Tom, good stuff. Thanks very much for joining us. More from Tom across offthewall.com, of course, on 98FM all day for you. Now, let's move on. Well, Manchester United went 2-0 up yesterday in the Cup. The BBC commentator uttered the words, "Crisis, what crisis?" Daniel Harris, nothing like a routine 6-0 win in the Cup to move all the clouds away and make everybody forget about the fact that the club is owned by people who the fans don't really want to own the club.
Well, I definitely don't think the away end forgot that that was the case. And obviously, it's nice to smash up an inferior team, but it won't change the way that things are under Solskjaer and have been. There's a couple of good games and a couple of bad games, and there's a small matter of an away game at Manchester City on Wednesday night.
This is it, isn't it? Every time there's a good result, there's a bad result. And every time there's a bad result so far, there's been a reasonable result to make everybody think, well, maybe he's actually learning. Maybe he just gets a little bit of time. Maybe if the club decides that they're going to commit to him for the next while, they might be able to pour their way out of this. But as that continues, the lows become lower and the highs no longer reach the heights that they used to. This is just a routine cup victory. No one should be saying that this is a meaningful stay of execution.
No, not really. I mean, I think I always come back to the same thing with Ole, in that he probably isn't good enough at the things you need to be good enough at to be the best manager that Manchester United could possibly have. But had he had a fair run with injuries, I don't think he'd be under very much pressure at the moment. In that United, currently they're fifth in the league, and he's been without Pogba for the whole season. He's been without McTominay for chunks of the season, and he's now without Rashford, and it's all at the same time. Had he had a fair run with injuries, then I think that he'd probably be okay in his job and people would be quite satisfied that there was progress. But you see certain games, so the game against Burnley, for example, where you think that he should still be doing slightly more than allow such a miserable performance to occur and do more from the touchline to do something about it. So I think, and this game coming up at City at the weekend, on Wednesday, sorry, is particularly worrying for those of us with an interest in the outcome, because it's very difficult to see that there's anything he can do to make that not, to make that be okay. And it's not simply a case of making sure that United don't get embarrassed. And I don't usually feel that. So, for example, when United played City in the league, I looked at the odds and I thought, ah, United are 8-1 to win. I'll have some of that. And whereas I look at the team that United are going to have to put out at the, on Wednesday, and it's more or less impossible to see how they can possibly do anything other than try and keep the score down. But obviously, you never know.
Yeah, like, I mean, that is the situation that we find Manchester United in at the moment, keeping the score down against Manchester City. Like, the tie, you would have to say, is dead at this moment. There is a lot of potential hope for Manchester United, though, if you look at a potential performance this week. Turning things around is probably a step too far. But, like, I don't know, Daniel. I think that there is still a huge amount to be gained from this midweek, this sort of saving face, because it wasn't so much just the result of the first Manchester City game. It was the sort of mood music around it at Old Trafford, the legends sitting in the crowd, clearly unhappy with what was going on. And it almost felt like the lowest ebb, whereas there's a part two to the lowest ebb. There is a par for saving face here.
Yeah, well, I mean, 3-1 with United's first 11 is not over. But 3-1 with the 11 United will have to put out is problematic. And, of course, the manner of the first half against City was not good. Although, I guess it's not really even the first half. Until City scored, United were actually, I thought, the better team in the game and were doing OK. And we've seen City do what they did to United in the last 25 minutes of that half. We've seen them do it to better teams than United as well. And what happened in that game was Guardiola worked out that, you know, if he paid 17 midfield players, United would not be able to get the ball. And if he does that again, it's pretty hard to see what United can do about it. And it's true that keeping the score down against City and not getting thrashed by Liverpool is no particular reason for celebration or no particular sign of progress. But that's where United are. And if we're talking specifically about Ole, I don't think that if you gave Pochettino the job, let's say, I would be no more confident going into this game. Even though I know Pochettino is a better manager than Ole, I saw good Spurs teams of his get whacked by City as well. So there's no easy answer, because the Glazers aren't going anywhere. And that is the principal problem at United, is that They have owners that have run an NFL franchise into the ground and are continuing to do so because the circle of money keeps going round. And they're now doing the same with United. I think the biggest change recently was that they've now stopped trying to get in the top four. If they'd given Ole another, let's say, £100 million, which sounds like a lot of money, but in the context of football clubs and in the context of one of the richest football clubs in the world, it's not really that much money at all. If they'd given Ole another £100 million for two midfield players, United would be ensconced in fourth and maybe third. And they didn't. And that tells you that they've given up even trying to get into the top four. Now, the problem for them is that their revenue streams are based, obviously, on television money and sponsorship money. And I think at the moment, it looks like the only thing that can possibly save United is the sponsors saying, actually, Mr. Potato Head is a very respectable brand. And we have no desire to be associated with a joke of a football club. And if the sponsors start to decide that they don't want anything to do with Manchester United because Manchester United are actually embarrassing their brand, then that might force the Glazers into action. But otherwise, the only thing that you can see happening that would make things better for United is selling to whichever human rights abusing oligarchs happen to be hanging about. Sorry, oligarchs, probably the wrong word. I think I probably mean plutocrats here. But sell to whichever human rights abusing plutocrats happen to be knocking around. And that also is the worst possible thing for United, in my opinion, in that I would much prefer United was owned by greedy carpetbaggers than by the kind of people that own Manchester City and PSG.
Can I ask you about the protests then? Are they ultimately pointless?
No, they're never pointless. The more attention that is drawn to this kind of thing, the better. The more uncomfortable the Glazers feel, the better. Ultimately, there's probably only one protest that would have the desired effect, and that is people not renewing their season tickets en masse. The time to do that really was in 2005, but then there was another opportunity in 2010. And the problem is that football is amazing, and football's not just about football. It's about history, it's about heritage, it's about tradition. People go to the game, it's about their lives. They go to the game, they go with their family, they go with their mates, and they do it every week. And giving that up is very hard to do, particularly if you don't think that other people will give it up. So the fans are in an invidious position where, in a sense, stopping the Glazers has sort of become incumbent upon them, but they have some element of power to stop that from happening, except what you're asking them to do is you're asking them to neglect, ignore, reject their personal family history and tradition and their lifestyle and their routine. And people are unwilling to do that with good reason. So the protests will always be important because the more people talk about this, the better. And the easier it is for the Glazers, the less likely they are to give the money that United need to be able to compete at the top level of the game. So the more of it that takes place, the better for United. But it's hard not to think that ultimately the Glazers will be sitting there in Tampa laughing while spending United's money. So it's a complicated and emotional and heart-wrenching situation. But the more abuse the Glazers get, the better for Manchester United.
In terms of the other stuff that's happening in football at the moment, Jurgen Klopp is saying that he won't even be around for the replay of the cup game after the 2-2 draw last night. We've seen Pep Guardiola also give out about the fixture situation, almost like Guardiola didn't have full awareness of how many games you play in a season, despite the fact that he's been around Manchester City for a couple of years here. What's your take on all this?
Honestly, I thought they both made dickheads of themselves. Let's take Guardiola first. Guardiola complaining that City is empty. It's expensive to watch football. Not everyone is as rich as him. So people not coming to a game at a very busy time of the season and a game that you know what the score is going to be, you know it's going to be fairly dull, should be easy for any sensitive person who understands the world to understand. But Guardiola is clearly an exceedingly self-obsessed narcissist. He may also be a footballing genius and savant as well, but we see that he doesn't really get it. And that was yet another example of the many things that he doesn't get. In the same way, he appreciates human rights in Catalonia, but not so much in Abu Dhabi. He just doesn't get it. And he ought to get it because it's not complicated and he's an intelligent man who is able to watch television and read newspapers, but he doesn't. Jurgen Klopp, I think, was probably speaking emotionally, having seen his team concede a two-goal lead against a team that they should be beating quite easily. And he was probably annoyed speaking in the aftermath of that because he's got another game he doesn't want. However, Jurgen Klopp is another intelligent, articulate individual who should understand that the FA Cup existed for a long time before he turned up in English football and would exist for a long time after he's gone. And I think that it's fine to complain about fixture congestion, but to then disrespect the competition by saying, well, it's so ludicrous that I'm not even going to participate in this, never mind my players, just made him look, again, like extremely self-obsessed and extremely narcissistic, because the FA Cup is an amazing competition. And I think what both he and Guardiola need to understand, because Guardiola was talking about binning off the League Cup last week as well, is that there are lower division teams that are not funded by venture capitalists and are not funded by billionaires and are not funded by human rights abusing plutocrats who are reliant on money from the League Cup, from FA Cup replays. And what Klopp should be doing is saying, for example, I'm pissed off with my players for letting that two-goal lead slip. I'm pissed off that we have to play a lot of games. But I understand that a replay at Anfield is monumental for Shrewsbury Town. And therefore, we're going to try and win the game. And if we win the game, we win the game. If we lose the game, we lose the game. And that would be fine. And people would understand. I mean, people have been complaining about fixture congestion for a long time. And it is difficult. The human body can only do so much. It can only peak so many times. So I wouldn't disrespect Klopp for not picking any first team players, but not turning up himself because he is somehow above this now made him look like an absolute throbber. Yeah. And there's no sensible way of saying that. And I don't think there is an other side to that particular line of the argument.
I think he might actually end up showing up. We'll wait and see if he's on the touchline or not.
That would be very kind of him.
He should do, really. He should do. And surely somebody's going to tap him on the shoulder and say, you need to show up. It's a big game. Show up. And, you know, fans are going to pay money to buy a ticket, and at least if they're not going to see the team, they should be able to see you. So
it's not so much about seeing him. I mean, no one's coming to see Jurgen Klopp. It's about the fact that he's the manager of Liverpool, and there's a game taking place in which Liverpool are playing. And so for him to say, I can't risk my good players because we've got to win the league. We want to retain the European Cup.
Yeah.
Everyone would understand that. People have been doing that for a long time. But saying he himself is not going to manage the team. Why? He's not playing. I mean, he does do a lot of prancing on the touchline, but I feel sure that he can manage one extra game without ruining his fitness for the prancing and touchline attention seeking that he will need to perpetrate during the course of the rest of the season. So all he had to do was say he was going to rest his players because it was an unwanted replay, but he would try and win the game, and it would be nice if he just said it would be good for Shrewsbury Town. But to say that he himself is not coming is pathetic.
Daniel, we got to go. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. Daniel Harris giving us some thoughts on a range of stories there. We're going to talk with Jason Sherlock about Kobe Bryant next here on OTBAM. First, though, here's LeBron James speaking on Saturday night, just after he surpassed Kobe Bryant's all-time NBA scoring record.
It does. It does in the fact that, when I was a kid, when I was in high school, I was growing up through the ranks. When Kobe came into the league, he was, it wasn't a dream of mine to come straight, from high school at that point in time to the NBA. But I was like, wow, a 17-year-old, 18-year-old kid being able to make that leap, that's pretty damn cool. And as I started playing more ball and I went into high school, the things that he was doing on the floor I, admired and wanted to be a part of. I went to ABCD camp. And he came and talked to all the kids that was there, and I happened to be one of the kids that was there, and I was just listening. I was just trying to soak everything up I could. And I remember one thing that he said, he was like, if you want to try to be, great at it or want to be one of the greats, you gotta put the work in. There's no substitution to work. And I was a 15-year-old kid at that camp. You can actually find the footage of him at that camp. And then 2001, I believe, I was playing in New Jersey, and the All-Star game, if I'm not mistaken, and y'all could correct me, was in Philly, right? Yeah, that Saturday, me and Maverick drove to the Intercontinental downtown Philadelphia, and he gave me a pair of his shoes, which I ended up wearing that following night. It was the red, white, and blue Kobe's. I was a 15, and he was a 14, and I wore them anyways. And I sat and just talked to him for a little bit. He gave me the shoes. I rocked them in the game. And it was the same night that we played Oak Hill against Melo. And then I saw what he was able to do the very next night, winning MVP here in Philly that same that following night.
So that's LeBron James speaking on Saturday night in the aftermath of passing Kobe Bryant in the all-time scorers list. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Karl Malone are 1 and 2. 3 is now LeBron James and 4 is Kobe Bryant. So that there were the impact that LeBron spoke about Kobe having on his career. I'm delighted to say this morning we've got Jason Sherlock with us. Jason, you obviously a basketball fan, a player, somebody who studied the game, somebody who kind of watched the career of Kobe Bryant. And it's remarkable too that Kobe Bryant was kind of one of those players who came along at the perfect moment in terms of being able to follow somebody 6,000 miles away, because email and the internet began around the same time as Kobe Bryant did, and so therefore we actually got much more exposure to him than we might have done previous generations. Can you talk to us a little bit about how much you followed his career and why you did?
Yeah, and I suppose obviously it's a very tragic situation that we all witnessed yesterday evening, just on a human level, as we know. But I suppose from a sporting point of view, I think, like so many greats, I think Kobe's legacy will be that there'll be so many sports people that don't really know anything about basketball that will be YouTubing him and looking for information on him. I was very fortunate enough to come across him at a very young age. I tweeted something last night, a good buddy of mine and a former teammate of mine, Emmett Donnelly. The Donnellys would be synonymous with Vincent's basketball. The family, all the guys played for the Super League team, and I think 3, if not 4, of them went to the States to high school. Emmett Donnelly was the third brother, and I suppose not like the first two. He played a lot of defense. He was known for shutting down players. So when Emmett came back from high school, he had the front page of the local newspaper, a picture of him and this guy called Kobe Bryant. And Emmett was telling us about how this guy was going to go to the NBA straight from high school. He was that good. And he certainly got my attention when we asked Emmett how he did. He said, "I shut him down. He only scored 32 on me. He's been scoring 50 on everyone else." So so I knew him very early in terms of who he was, and obviously I followed his career from then. As a sports fan, I was a Celtics fan, and I was a Michael Jordan fan. So probably in my younger days, I was a bit dismissive of Kobe. But I think as he got older and as I got older, I probably had more respect for his game.
It was probably more than being dismissive, I'd imagine, Jason. I'd say as an opposition supporter, he'd be one of the worst people to be coming up against. I know obviously there were some titanic Lakers-Celtics games, particularly in kind of the second stage of Kobe's Lakers career. And I guess that kind of came from his work ethic and from the unbelievable desire he had to win at all costs. Being an opposition fan, being a non-Lakers fan, watching Kobe Bryant, I'd say it was a bit more than dismissive. I'd say people actively hated his guts as a sports fan.
Well, yeah, and again, he had a great quote about people that hated him, but you're right, there were two things. One, as an individual player, the comparisons to Michael Jordan. For me, Michael was the GOAT and is the GOAT, and again, for anyone even to be in the same conversation of Michael, particularly when Michael was still playing, I think it's a bit different from LeBron now because they're kind of removed, but to actually play in that environment and to be able to excel, and again, the influence that Michael had on his career and how he admired him and how he kind of tailored his game very similar to Michael. And then as a team, I think Kobe played the game with a chip on his shoulder, and in his first kind of stint with the Lakers, or the first monopoly, he had Shaq, and he probably didn't get the credit that he deserved. And then to go and be successful without necessarily having Shaq, no different than Michael, he appreciated the players around him. It wasn't good enough to be the best player he could be. He had to make his teammates better. So as a sports person, to be able to look at that and see how he was able to interpret that and how he was able to influence his teammates was very special. And then as he finished playing, to be able to look back and understand what was actually going on in games, like for me, it's Michael, it's Kobe, and it's LeBron. LeBron and Michael, I suppose they were very dependent and are very dependent on their talent. Kobe was a different player. He seemed to have to work for everything. So as an athlete, to be able to understand that, to be able to interpret what's going on, there's a great movie there, Kobe Doing Work, that was directed by Spike Lee. And that just gave you an insight into his mindset, the way that he was able to picture every play, every situation, not only from his perspective, but he could see it from his teammates' perspective. To be able to have that presence, that poise to understand the situation, it's really enlightening. And again, as I said, I'm sure there'll be a lot of young sports people checking Kobe out this morning.
So it was his brain as well as his talent that separated him.
Absolutely. Like, I think that the great ones, it is always between the ears, you know. The physical talent, yes, some people have more than others, but ultimately it will come down between the ears. And again, when you combined the unique talent that he had with the work ethic, and again, he was known as the Black Mamba, he understood that once he crossed the line, he had a different personality, and he was so competitive, and he brought that to obviously on the court, but also far away from the court. And again, their values that are very inspiring. And it was a shock to me when I saw the fallout of the kind of the newer players, let's say. I suppose I'm at an age where I'm still caught up with Michael Jordan as being my hero, but like to see all these young players that were obviously so impacted by Kobe and his legacy, it's really surreal and shocking to think that a guy that had so much to offer is no longer with us.
The Olympic Games is something that I think maybe if you're kind of not a regular NBA fan, you don't fully appreciate just how important the Olympic Games tends to be to this group of players, because they get to play together for the one time in their careers. And it's funny how when the American sites and the American news casters were listing off his achievements, the two gold medals were almost in advance of the two finals MVPs. And then you begin to think of, like, why is that? And it turns out that he ends up playing with LeBron and I think with Dwayne Wade and a couple of others who all go on to have amazing seasons the year after the Olympic Games, apparently inspired by the fact that they got to hang out with Kobe and they got to see exactly that work ethic that you're talking about. They realised that he's at the level he's at, not because of his talent, but because of the time that he spends in the gym. He was such a stratospheric superstar at that point that he didn't even stay in the same hotel as LeBron and everybody else. It was like, you know, he is at a level above them all. But at the same time, he was first in the gym and last to leave.
Yeah, and like again, I've been very fortunate enough in my own playing career and from a coaching point of view, you see these individuals, and that's when people talk about culture and environment, role models. Like, that's what you want from players, you know, that to kind of to show the way. And I had a few of them that had a big impact on me, and I've no doubt in that situation that would have been similar for those guys. And again, that's the legacy that he left. That's the benchmark that he had. And you spoke and you played a bit of LeBron's interview there about the impact that he had on LeBron's career. And look at LeBron now. Actually, the end of that interview, if people get a chance, it's worth listening to, particularly in light of what happened yesterday. It just puts everything in perspective. But yeah, that's the impact that he left. And as I said, it seems that today and for the next few days that people will realise what a competitor he was. And you only have to look at the people that have already spoken out publicly and how upset they are with the news. It's the mark of the man, not only the man, but the player as well.
Jason, great. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Sher.
So Jason Sherlock giving us some thoughts on Kobe Bryant. If you've just joined us, we did cover the other aspect of Kobe Bryant's legacy with Kavitha Davidson of The Athletic, where we talked about the incident in Colorado where he was accused of rape. It was after the first threepeat, I think I got my timeline here right. So unbelievably famous at that point. Just how complicated his legacy is going to be, because there are people who just absolutely think that this is one of the most important figures in basketball history, and certainly of this century he is absolutely the most important. Like, LeBron hasn't quite reached that level yet and might well reach that level, but it was Kobe and then it's him from the year 2000 onwards.
Yeah, basically. Like I just kind of like two of the kind of last memories of a basketball player that kind of stick out to me. Like, I remember getting up in the middle of the night to watch the Game 7 in 2010, which was Lakers against Boston, and you're looking at that Celtics team and they just had icons everywhere, and Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, Ray Allen. And then for Lakers at the time, kind of only having a passing interest in that NBA season, like, Kobe was really the only unbelievable superstar in that team. Like, they obviously had the likes of Ron Artest and stuff like that in that team, but Kobe really carried him to that finals win in 2010, which was back-to-back titles, MVP in those finals. That's one thing that sticks out to me. Then also, his last game. Like, he put up 60 points in his last game in 2016, which... you can look at it two ways. The kind of emotion that I kind of had when I saw that was like, oh, typical Kobe, you know, like wanting to kind of be ruthless to his very last seconds as an NBA player. And I think that kind of like summed him up as a player. But you're right, there were so many more complicating aspects to his legacy, especially after the allegations from Colorado in 2003. Like, it changes everything in terms of how you talk about him.
Right, 10 minutes past nine. A little bit earlier this morning before we came on air, Owen caught up with a friend of the show, Ryan Farmer-Jones, editor emeritus of Slam magazine. Here he is reacting to the death of Kobe Bryant and why he was still such a hugely prominent figure in American life.
Yeah. I had a lot of conversations with a lot of friends and former coworkers and people around basketball today. And a couple of different people sort of made that point that, you know, you have a guy who's such a high level athlete and so prominent and so well known and so accomplished for 20 years. And then they retire, you know, after a few years, and you think, you know, well, you'll have this person will be around. You know, I think he was 5 years younger than me. So you think you'll have this person around most of the rest of your life. You'll be able to sort of ponder their accomplishments and see what else they're going to do, you know, in retirement. Kobe had a lot of different things going on. And so, yeah, it's just kind of crazy. It makes it that much more crazy because he still seemed a guy who had a lot going on, was still very active, was an ambitious guy, wanted to be involved in entertainment and business and all sorts of things. And then obviously the worst part of this is that, you know, a guy with four daughters coaching one of them and you know, had a family still to raise. And so, yeah, that's made it a surreal thing, just that much worse.
You mentioned there that you're of a similar age to Kobe Bryant. I'm sure as a sports writer, as a basketball writer, he was a central thread in your career as well. You would have seen him from the hugely prominent high school career he had, the huge story that it was with him skipping college as a guard at the time. That was a particularly seismic moment for the NBA. Can you talk us through a little bit like that about his career arc and probably how your own career arc went along with that as well?
Yeah, I was remembering earlier, I actually saw him play one quarter of a game in high school, just one quarter. It was a playoff game, and I was working my first job out of college, and I was covering a different high school tournament, a state tournament game in Pennsylvania, and his team was in the next gym. So I went to watch, and I saw him play one quarter, and I think his team was winning 20-0 at the end of the first quarter. I think he had 12 or 14 points, but just clearly dominated. He looked like he could have gone 1-on-10. He was so good. And then I didn't really, his first few years of the NBA, I wasn't too close, but I was a Laker fan. I'd grown up a Laker fan, so he was sort of my new favorite player. And then I got to Slam in 1999 and covered him pretty extensively while I was at Slam and spent a fair amount of time around him. And we, you know, did a few, you know, feature interviews for stories in Slam. And so, yeah, I don't think I got to know him well, and I'm not sure anybody really did. That was part of what made him interesting, is that he was a tough guy to sort of really get to know. He was something of a enigma is not the right word necessarily, but he was just a really complex guy. And I think, you know, he sort of famously early in his career, even his teammates were like, yeah, this guy doesn't want to hang out with us on the road. He's, you know, he's sort of aloof. He was kind of estranged from his family a bit early on. So we have this really interesting background and really interesting story. But a guy, yeah, that I had a chance to spend a lot of time with and was obviously very intelligent, very charismatic, as everyone talks about, just a ridiculous competitor. So competitive, relentlessly competitive. You know, obviously did not go through his career without some controversy, and which is a light way of putting it. But that, you know, sort of hung over him for the second half of career, but of his career. But he kept going and sort of just on the strength of winning and sort of being so relentless at what he cared about. you know, sort of just made himself this sort of irreplaceable kind of icon in basketball over the past 20 years. Obviously, a lot of people have mixed feelings about aspects of his life, understandably. But as far as his impact on the game, his influence, I was trying to think earlier of a comparison. So much has come out today about the current players in the NBA today who grew up idolizing him and modeling their game on his. And I think it's hard to convey how hard this hit so many current NBA players who maybe, you know, had only met him once or twice, but they grew up wanting to be like Kobe. And I mean, a comparison that came to mind would be someone almost like a Thierry Henry. You know, how many strikers growing up, you know, kids over the past, you know, who were kids, you know, 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago, that would have been the guy they would have wanted to grow up and be. And then imagine having that taken away just a few years after he retired. So his impact on the NBA and this generation of players now was just remarkable and massive, which I think is what makes this kind of all the more poignant.
Yeah, I think that competitor is what a lot of people are going to speak about in the aftermath of all of this. Yeah. I guess incomparable levels to which he tried to succeed in the game that obviously created opinions of him when you were up against him, when you were an opposition fan, I'd imagine, yeah, where he was always the bad guy on the court. Like, this is something that's probably going to be his legacy on the game. As you mentioned, the kids are not just, the kids that became, are now the stars in the NBA are not just looking at this guy as an unbelievably talented shooter. They're looking at this guy who brought competitiveness to a whole new level. And I think perhaps if you look through his Lakers career, the post-Shaq era is probably something that he got a lot of joy from personally, because it was about Kobe this time. It wasn't just about Shaquille O'Neal.
Yeah, it was always fascinating to watch. And again, I was a Laker fan when they first got together. And so I sort of, you know, to watch that. And as a Laker fan, you just wanted it to work. You didn't care if they liked each other, right? You just wanted it to work and see them succeed. But when Shaq left, and that was around the time that then he and I had talked a fair amount, I'd had a chance to have a lot of access to him. And there was that sort of constant fight you could see with him. He wanted to win more than anything. And having Shaq next to him helped him win. Mm. But he also wanted to do it on his own terms, and he wanted to be the guy. And he couldn't do that as long as Shaq was there. So when Shaquille O'Neal left and Kobe was clearly the guy on those teams, he still needed help. But that was sort of another level to him that you saw that he really, and it was, you know, that Jordan, that career-long comparison to Michael Jordan, he replicated Jordan as closely as anyone ever could have. And to be able to then have a team where, you know, again, post Shaq, like you said, they were clearly his teams and he was clearly the guy. You really got to see him sort of at his peak as a competitor.
Yeah, like you mentioned there as well, the sort of level to which he'd gone to post-career. I think, you know, he skipped college. If he'd gone through college, I think the general consensus is that he would have flown through it, that he was gifted no matter what he was going to do. He was a smart guy. Can you talk us through what he had done post-career? Like, I mean, winning an Oscar, all that sort of stuff, that had actually shown Kobe Bryant as a man who was going to succeed in business. He could have become a coach, he could have become a GM, who knows what he was going to do, right, if he'd gotten back into basketball. But he had shown so many characteristics off the court that he was going to succeed.
Yeah, I was actually about a month ago, right before Christmas here, I was out in California visiting family, and a friend of mine, a former co-worker of mine from Slam, now works for Kobe's company. And so my family and I had a chance to kind of tour his office, and I think we missed Kobe by 10 minutes. That afternoon, I hadn't seen him in years, and we missed him that day. But my friend who works for him now sort of gave us the tour of his space there, his office space in Southern California. And he's got sort of studio space, and there's, you know, creative space for people editing videos, to which ESPN used, where Kobe would analyze things. And there was just all these levels of Kobe's creativity and his business acumen and his competitiveness all sort of coming together in this space. And he had this team of people who worked for him, and you just got a sense of his vision. It was very much about the things he wanted to do, the things he cared about. They were working on editing a documentary that I assume will still come out at some point on his final NBA season. And my friend who worked there made the point, he's like, you know, if you look at all the things like LeBron is doing, for example, LeBron is big on partnering with big established, you know, entertainment things or businesses, which is fine. Whereas Kobe's thing was he wants to do all those things on his own. He wants to be his vision. And that's very consistent with my experience with him when we were at Slam. He was trying to dictate cover choices for us. Other athletes didn't do that. So he was just a very unique guy that way. And I think he, yeah, I mean, it was a pretty high ceiling as far as what he might have continued to do in his career. It was going to be whatever he wanted to do, he would have pulled off.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I guess kind of a couple of points to wrap up then. I mean, you mentioned Southern California there. You can just imagine the scenes there over the last 12 hours or so. It's a place that fell in love with Kobe Bryant, I think it's fair to say. I think when we talk about the basketball player and how a lot of people would have seen him as the basketballing villain, as their opposition teams, you flipped that in Southern California as a Lakers fan yourself. Like, what has that reaction been like from the people you've spoken to in that part of the world right now?
That's really one of the things that's been driven home. I'm from Southern California. I haven't lived there in many years, but I'm from out there. Again, I grew up a huge Laker fan. And someone today on Twitter actually made the point that, you know, Los Angeles is this massive spread out area with, I don't know, 20 million people or something. And so diverse and so, you know, diverse economically and racially and ethnically and just so spread out. It sprawls and sprawls and sprawls over hundreds of miles. And it's not crazy to say that the Lakers are almost the only sort of entity or institution that really unites that whole area. Sort of everyone's a Laker fan in Southern California. They've been so good for so long and had so many compelling, iconic, great players. So and Kobe was that guy for 20 years. So if you grew up, you know, if you were born in the past 30 or 35 years, Kobe was your guy. On this team that united your entire area in a way that nothing else did, you know, politically, socially, culturally. So it's, I think, hard, as big of a deal as he is nationally, even internationally, I think for folks in Southern California, this is it's hard to comprehend how big this is for them. And I mean, the outpouring, I think, you know, of grief and shock and all that, I think you saw a bit of that today, but I think you'll see a lot more of it over the coming days. It's just he was huge and iconic and beloved really throughout that area.
Yeah, it's actually just interesting that you mentioned the timeline here as well. There is one of the kind of lesser points in all of this is how Bryant has navigated his way through a whole new series of technologies as a sports person and as somebody involved in the media yourself. You're probably well placed to speak on this, how he'd gone from the poster boy of the print world to now the Instagram world, which obviously basketball fits so perfectly within, and you have kids who recognize Kobe as a brand, and you have people in their mid-40s to 60s who would have been kids as fans of Kobe getting their news through the print medium, I guess, when he first came along.
He really, you know, his career kind of covered that whole span, like you said. I mean, you know, as a rookie in 1996, Slam, our magazine, had just started 2 years earlier, so he was one of the guys very early on with Slam, where for us it was all about our covers and our posters that kids could hang on their walls, and he was a star for us, both on our covers and the posters and the kind of, you know, photos we would choose in the magazine. We always knew we could count on amazing Kobe action shots. And then as it started to turn into an internet thing, you know, the YouTube highlights of his are legendary. A lot of those have been flying around today. And then, you get into the social media age. My own son is 15 years old. And he really only knows Kobe as a guy that he's seen highlights of on Instagram, you know. But he knows from that this guy was something special. There's just these layers. There's these layers to his career and the eras that he spanned. And like you were saying, again, he was going to be, you know, he was clearly already in his post-playing career. Focused on, you know, sort of creating these new chapters for himself where he was going to make an impact in entertainment and business and who knows what else.
Has there been a more compelling American athlete?
I think I said that today. Mm. And I don't think there has been in my lifetime. And listen, that's good and bad, right? I mean, you know, this is a guy who was credibly accused of sexual assault 17 or 18 years ago, whatever it was. And that was a huge, obviously, turning point in his career that people sort of didn't know if he would come back from. And he did. And it was, you know, obviously never went to court, settled. So, you know, obviously that understandably creates difficult feelings for people. But from his personal background, a kid who was basically born and raised overseas in Italy when his father was playing professionally for much of his childhood, and then to come back to America as an African-American kid who hadn't spent that much time in sort of the dominant African-American culture, especially, you know, that was predominant in basketball and in hip hop at the time. And to be a peer of someone like Allen Iverson, who was kind of iconic for, you know, the sort of hip hop vibe that was kind of taken over basketball at that time. And he wasn't sort of born into that in the way a lot of guys were, but he adapted to it and embraced it. And people forget a lot of people had a hard time embracing Kobe for who he was earlier in his career. There was a lot of skepticism about him, that he was a guy who just tried to emulate Michael Jordan and didn't really sort of come to the culture of basketball at the time, naturally and sincerely in a way. A lot of people forget that about him. And he, again, I said earlier, kind of just through force of will and just relentlessly winning and competing the way he did, kind of just negated all those questions about where he was from or what he was about, because it was just such respect for how competitive and relentless and great he was. And what a winner he was, obviously. And so a lot of those other doubts and that skepticism about him kind of disappeared over time in a way that even now I'm thinking about it, it's kind of, you sort of forget about it, you know, that there were any questions about Kobe sort of belonging in a way. And there really were early on. So yeah, to your question, I think just an incredibly compelling character in American sports and international sports, as big as basketball is. I mean, was talking to someone earlier who made the point, you know, when this news were to sort of hit China, when China wakes up, he was huge, massive in China. And that's such a massive market for the NBA as well. So, his reach, I think, has been profound. And his story and his character through all this has been a fascinating thing to follow. I've been lucky, I think, to follow him for, you know, almost 25 years in one form or another. And just very sad about this right now.
Yeah, like just because you mentioned it there a couple of times, like it's a tricky thing to talk about, I guess, or some people don't want to talk about in the immediate aftermath of such a tragedy, because it is a tragedy. Yeah. But when it comes to the sexual assault allegation, like it is something that has marked his career with a bad mark, really, down through the years. It's something that you can accept as a horrible thing that has happened, and at the same time also analyse the failings in Kobe Bryant's own life and his own career. Both of these things can be true. You can appreciate the tragedy as well that has happened last night. Like, this is going to affect the legacy. This is going to affect how people speak about Kobe Bryant. And I just wonder how much is that going to permeate into what we see on the ground, especially in somewhere like Southern California, where he is a god.
Right. I mean, I think for the most part, basketball people, basketball fans, other players, basketball media, for the most part, are not going to focus on that. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be a mention in every obituary. I think it has to be. But I don't think it'll be the defining thing for really anybody who's very close to basketball. Again, that's not to minimize what is alleged to have happened. Just to say that if you look at the entirety of his life and career and how much he accomplished, and, you know, obviously it's been fascinating to watch in recent years. He's become such a strong advocate for women's basketball and girls' basketball, obviously coaching his daughter. But he's been among the biggest proponents of women's professional basketball and even women's college basketball here. And that's been a real change in recent years for, you know, NBA players and former NBA players to embrace the women's league and the women's game. And he was at the forefront of that. So that's part of who he was, as well as being, you know, a loving father of four daughters and everything else he's been involved in. So, you know, without judging, I guess you can just sort of acknowledge all of that together as part of who he was. And, you know, again, I think, like you asked earlier, to the extent of what a compelling character he was in so many ways, that thread is a big part of it.
Yeah, for sure. Listen, Ryan Farmer-Jones, it's been great chatting to you. Thanks a million for staying up late for us tonight. Thanks for taking the call.
Thanks, Tom.
Right, time for us to wrap up the story, the entire weekend, with the biggest story of the weekend. Kevin Kilbane is still dancing on ice. He's got one more week to go. You made it. Your birthday's next week, right?
Yeah, what is that? Oh, I've got one more week. Can I get through next week again?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you tell us.
Yeah, does it look like I'm at the end of the road? Is that kind of how it's feeling now, is it?
Well, all I'm doing is going by your stated ambition was to just make it past your birthdays.
Yeah, we said that. We said that. Go to the birthdays and that's it. So we'll see now. I don't know, it was good crack last night because I didn't expect to get through last night, actually. But it was, we had good fun anyway. We had good fun in the bar afterwards as well.
I'd say so. It's amazing. Obviously, the public have really got on your side because the scores perhaps weren't what you expected last night or weren't what you were aiming for, so the public have taken to you. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, well, the scores certainly what I wasn't really expecting at the start. I obviously wanted to get better, but the skate was crap, like, wasn't it? Let's be honest. So I can't really go beyond that. I was terrible last night, but it's the way it is. I don't know. I think there was maybe a bit more of a push last night. I think a few friends maybe got on Instagram, got on Twitter, and give us a bit of a push. And I think there's the Irish supporters branches over here as well, got behind me as well over the weekend. So that was good. So I got a bit of support last night, which was great.
My theory, Kevin, is that you should just go all out next week and do your most complicated skate next. And no matter how it goes, you're going to be a win, because either A, you pull off a really complicated routine and you get higher scores, or B, you fall on your arse and everyone will feel perhaps more sorry for you, and that sympathy vote just gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, there's maybe something in that as well. I've been getting technical analysis off Nathan Murphy in the bar till probably midnight last night, telling me exactly what I should be doing next week, what track I should be going to, what moves I should be pulling off, how I should be impressing the judges. So Nathan's given me all last night, so we've got it sorted what we're going to do.
What colour are your fingernails next week, Kev?
That was actually when I got back in last night as well. So yeah, there you go. Yeah, there you go, Jay. Have you got anything to say?
A good night.
It was good. It was a good night. We had a really good night. Nathan was on the red wine. The red wine was flowing with him. He was letting himself down a little bit. He was starstruck in the room. He was going around Mora, getting photographs. Owen, he was chatting to John Barrowman. He was giving John Barrowman a bit of stick as well in the bar after the game. He was, yeah.
Dead right. So how does Nathan Murphy approach Maura Higgins for a selfie then?
She was floating around. She's good crack, so she came over for a bit of a chat with the lads. So I had a couple of friends over as well. So Nathan and his wife Debbie were there. So Nathan was all over. Nathan was purely starstruck. Honest to God, he was.
In the middle there, you can see his beard. And look, what's that? He's wrapped. He's literally wrapped in the Mayo flag.
Oh yeah, the Mayo flag's been out in force all week. Yeah, He was desperate to get it out all night anyway. We had a photograph down by the ice. But he didn't let it loose from his arms all evening.
I mean, look, the man is committed. What can you say? Yeah. So next week they told us it's a fairy tale. I mean, look, you know, you know, Prince Charming, is that who you're going to be in the fairy tale? Or
I don't even know what my track is yet. In recent weeks, they've given us we've kind of got an idea what the track would be the following week on the Thursday and the Friday. But I think they expected me to go last night. I think that's kind of how it was. So I've not even been told, but I'll get to know what the track is today, and then we'll get the routine in place.
But you weren't even in the bottom two, so that's a good sign. There's a chance that, like, you know, worst case scenario, you're like slightly ahead of the person. You might be in the skate off next week.
If I'm in the skate off, I'm gone. Let's be honest about that. Now I can't. Everyone that's left now, they're all way better. So that's where I'm at. So I've got to avoid the skate off to be in next week.
Can you get better? One of the judges was like, "I just want you to get better." It's like, is it too late? I mean, you know, the whole there was a little bit of it seemed like a double entendre about are you practicing with your hips at one point?
Yeah. Well, do you know, I think. It took me so long to get the basics. Everybody seemed to have the basics before they even started. That was the thing. So I was way behind to start. That was the level that I was at. So the basics took me probably 6 weeks. And then you're almost going straight into your routine at that stage, 6-8 weeks in. And that was kind of where I'm at. So I'm still way behind on basics. So I'm still doing stuff that probably the guys were doing 2 months ago. That's where I'm still trying to get up to speed on.
Yeah. You know, your physical shape seems good. Your back, it's totally fine.
Feel good. Feel great. Honestly, I've said that to you the week, didn't I? My back. I'm pain free for the first time in about 15, probably 20 years.
It's a bit mad.
Honestly,
isn't it?
It's incredible. Yeah, it really is. And that's, yeah, it's all down to posture. It's how you present yourself, how you hold yourself, everything like this. Yeah.
And the dyed red streaks in the hair, is that something you're going to commit to in the future?
No, well, I think you know that. Can you still see? I had a bit of guy liner in last night as well. Can you still see that?
Ah, yeah.
A bit of the eyeliner in there. So, I said to you, when we started, Jerry, I said to you, didn't I? Look, I'm in it. You just got to go with it. And that's it. So whatever they dress me in now.
Tommy wants to know, can you keep the clothes? I think he wants to borrow them for Halloween.
Oh, does he? Yeah. Does he want it? I thought he might want it for something else, you know. But anyway, he can borrow the outfit from last night. Yeah, don't have that. He can have the vest. I'd say Tommy would look well down Meath Hill, wouldn't he, going out in the biker vest.
Straight in training on it. Kev, best of luck. Keep it going. Keep it lit. Cheers.
Yeah, don't expect me on. I always say to you, don't expect me on next week. Next week's the birthday weekend. It could be a heavy night, so you might not see me next week.
Ah, look, we want live footage for wherever you are at 9:30 on Monday morning. Come on, perfect.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, that could be. I could be still awake at that stage.
Yeah, perfect. Right, good luck. See you.
Cheers, lads. All the best. Take it easy.
Kevin Coban giving us some reaction. Post-match analysis. He did after the game we were in. So he's treating it like a game.
Very honest.
As he should be.
Searing honesty from Kevin Coban there about his performance last night.
Are we to expect... missed the lead. You made your ITV debut last night.
I did.
How many people spotted it?
Not many people. I think I've got like 2 messages.
Right. You took it up on your own.
Expecting about 4 or 5. No, I might put it up today. We'll see.
Yeah.
Might delete later. Who knows?
How was it though? You must have been like...
Well, like it was.
You've got an agent now, I presume.
Yeah, my people spoke to their people, and right. They got that set up. And yeah, it was basically Kevin and Brianne were watching me on an iPad, so I was watching them, and it was a very unusual Sunday evening's experience.
Yeah,
I will say it is unfair that this kid from Diversity is allowed to compete
because he can dance.
Yeah, like people are like, well, it's on ice and it's different.
It's not.
Like he's got far more natural grace. Like the way his arms move just looks natural to him, whereas to Kevin Coban, he just looks like iRobot or something like that. It's just we're coming from impossibly different places here, the diversity background and the footballing background.
Yeah, it's true. It is unfair, but he's made it this far. He's going to be okay. Next week's the end, probably. Nathan got his night out in London.
Well, the thing is, he wasn't in the bottom.
His selfie at Mora.
All he's got to do is move up at most one place in the voting. If he can wrap up a bit more support this week, if he can do something, just something that will actually remind people of why he's on ice next week, that would be good.
Something charitable, some massive act of charity this week.
Yeah, wouldn't go astray. I think a fall. I think he just needs to fall.
No, because a fall, it's done. You can't. No one will vote for you if you fall.
But they might. I think the exact opposite. I think people love a good story of redemption. And Kevin Coban getting back up off the ice if and when he falls next week would be a great story of redemption.
Right. 9:37, we've gone way over time. That's it from us this Monday morning on OTBM. Thanks very much for joining us. Off the Ball, back in your radios tonight at 7 o'clock. You can subscribe to the OTBAM podcast. Fully timestamped, making it very easy to find exactly what you want from every morning's 2-hour show. If you missed anything, Caritha Davidson, Jason Sherlock and Ryan Jones on the passing of Kobe Bryant. Gaelic football with Anthony Moyles. Football with Daniel Harris. The sports pages and your top 5 stories. We'll get more into them on tomorrow's show. You can find us on podcasts wherever you get them or on YouTube. You can also cast us to your smart TV. Best place to get our podcasts is the Go Loud app. OTBM, Ireland's only first sports breakfast show, here every morning from 7:30. We'll see you tomorrow morning at 7:30. Best of luck.
OTB AM. This. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.